Do you trust him?
Trust.
But does he trust you?
He's in the suspicion business. He can't trust anybody.
But they all are. How could anybody sneak in and fool?
Maybe nobody did.
Then...
maybe there's another CIA. Inside the CIA.
This is Bristol. It's Friday afternoon, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Frome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, who's also a mental health specialist. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, an abortive US attack on oil-rich Venezuela, an act of war, like the regular Israeli acts of war now bombing Syria. But these attempts of our so-called allies to start wars, these war crimes, are going virtually unreported in the London media. And Germany issues what some have called a declaration of war there against the European Central Bank. What does this mean for much-needed Eurozone bailouts and, of course, the future of the European Union? And a BBC news report, the Dawn Chorus Day last weekend, but they didn't report on the news International Press Freedom Day. Was their former employee George Orwell right about them being the Ministry of Truth, a clear and present danger to the nation? And the real VE Day behind the BBC hype, betrayal and victory on the 8th of May 1945. First, the atom bomb, evidence emerging over the last two or three years through official documents and the discovery of radioactive material in Germany that the Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944, 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 45. Then the deals done by Churchill, Roosevelt and Truman for $1 billion in looted wealth, for Nazi enriched uranium, for experimental data from barbaric human testing, all carried out through the working to death of human prisoners in Hitler's so-called Untermensch. And the greatest betrayal, perhaps, of all, the aid given by the Allied leaders to a covert financial Fourth Reich of banksters and transnational corporations, the SS in suits and their supporters, an international mafia directing an international NATO Bilderberg mafia even unto this day, some say. And finally, on VE Day, whatever happened to Winston Churchill's finest hour speech about Britain standing up to the threat to Christian civilization, when Christians sometimes are now prosecuted through the British courts for practicing what they preach? That's all in the second hour. So, joining me to review this week's news, it's Labour councillor from Frome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Hi, Nicola. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you, Tony.
Now, first of all, Nicola, how's things going? How's the council managing to function? First of all, I suppose, under the problems of the lockdown and social distancing, are council meetings actually happening? Is democracy chugging along fine?
Yes, we're having meetings by Zoom and they're proving very effective. One thing I will say, we haven't quite worked out yet how to involve the public in these meetings, but certainly internal meetings are happening and they're happening very well and very often.
I mean, surely, for example, you could live stream these meetings and the public could then actually do live comments alongside. I mean, quite a few people seem to be able to cope with that without too much trouble.
Yeah, some of the meetings are being live streamed. Like I said earlier, I think we've got a problem really in how we get feedback from the general public. I think that's something we really need to work at. I don't know whether people find it easier to stage questions so that they've got prepared answers, but I do think there needs to be a bit more spontaneity in terms of how we engage with members of the public.
What about the mayor? He's been doing these live Facebook chats and members of the public, he's answering their questions there.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, surely that's something that hasn't really been happening much in the past. He's done a few of those, but he's doing them fairly regularly now.
I think he has done some in the past. You know, we got an election in a year's time. So I think it's a really good idea that we do some of those things.
I mean, what about, you mentioned the election there, what about this whole idea? We're supposed to have had an election yesterday, and if the people in your part of the city, in Frome Vale, weren't happy with you, they would have voted you out yesterday.
Well, actually, I wasn't standing in Frome Vale, so they wouldn't have had the chance to vote me in anyway. So that they've got to put up with me for an extra year. I recognise that. And I really want to make sure that they get the best service they can from me. So I think that's really important. They haven't had a choice about me being their councillor for another year. So, you know, I think I've got to honour that and do what I can to support them.
I mean, isn't there quite a serious problem here, though? If we've had elections delayed for a year, that simply means for this next year, we don't actually have democracy in Bristol.
You could argue that. And, you know, it would be healthy, I think, at some point to revisit some of the decisions that were made in the council, because they were made in the understanding that there would be a new term of office for maybe the mayor and other councillors. But democracy is not just about voting in elections, is it? It's all the other ways people get to contribute to decision-making in the city and have a voice.
Well, and also, yes, and have a voice, which we don't have on FM anymore, which is a great pity. We're still doing what we can to get BCFM's managing editor, Pat Hart, to allow these programmes to go out on FM. But at the moment, he's decided it's just too dangerous, because if he gets complaints, he will then have to deal with them through Ofcom. But anyway, that goes on, that struggle to get back onto FM. But look, I mean, at the end of the day, Nicola, for example, in France a couple of weeks ago, they had local elections there. Why can't we have them?
I think there's an electoral commission that have decided that, and it's about social distancing. You know, how do we do door knocking? How do we talk to people? How do we gauge what their interests are? All those things are really tricky to do. And I think it's a lot safer if we just hold these elections off for a year.
Well, say, for example, you can reach constituents through the media, for example, through the newspapers, through the radio.
We can reach some of the constituents that way, but there's an awful lot of people who don't have access to those things. I mean, you know, One way isn't the answer. You need to try lots of different ways.
And what about actually voting? I mean, what you could easily do, I mean, I'm not talking about you personally, but it doesn't seem to me to be rocket science to be able to hold an election within rules that don't endanger people. Say, for example, you know, you have social distancing and queuing at polling stations. You could quite easily sanitise ballot papers without too much trouble, and you could arrange the count, you know, so that people are certain distance. I can remember when I was a green candidate in Clifton years ago, I actually got the head of legal services come over to me and tick me off for being less than 2 metres away from the person doing the count. And he said I would be expelled from the building if I got any closer. So it seems to me that, you know, with some of the rules that exist at the moment for the counts and for paper elections, that we could do that within the rules of social distancing, and that possibly this is just an excuse not to have an election for people that want to stay in power.
Tony, I'm wondering if those rules weren't about electoral rules, but were about your personal hygiene. I'd just like to say.
Actually, I can tell you what it was about is they said that candidates were not allowed to physically get any closer than 2 metres to people actually doing the count. And it wasn't my personal hygiene, thank God for once.
The last time I attended a local authority camp, it lasted 3 days. Would you really want to inflict that sort of thing, plus all the social distancing difficulties onto people? We'd probably be there for 2 months. But seriously, it does stop campaigning, and you'd end up with an election which isn't really about politics. So, you know, we've got to do this thing and delay it for a year. But I do think there is a case for looking at some of the decisions that were made in the council on the assumption that there would be an election this year. So there is a.
So which of those decisions do you think, you know, stands out as something that the cancellation of the election has made a difference to then?
Well, off the top of my head, I think councillors' allowances, that needs to be revisited.
So are councillors getting more allowances or less now?
There is going to be an increase.
I mean, I've got in front of me Marvin Rees's April 2019 re-election statement, which is what the local parties, Labour parties, approved, so that he could be the candidate in this election. That didn't happen yesterday, but will happen in a year's time. I mean, he's saying, for example, that in that statement he promises, he's saying we're reducing City Hall senior management and freezing top pay. Well, he hasn't frozen top pay at all, has he? He's actually increased his own pay by, I think it's around about 12-13%, by £9,000.
He may not consider that to count as top pay.
I mean, all the other members of the cabinet too, also their pay has increased. I mean, what we've seen in other parts of the world, certainly I've, you know, come back in the last couple of weeks from New Zealand, where their cabinet did the total opposite. They said, well, because of all the hardship we are putting people through with our lockdown rules, we're going to take a 25% drop in pay. Whereas here in Bristol, we've got the opposite. We've got the mayor and the cabinet all saying they're going to pay themselves more.
I mean, we have seen a reduction in the number of senior directors, but, you know, you're absolutely right. There are companies across the UK where people are taking a 20% cut in their salary to sort of replicate the people that are being furloughed. So those things are going on.
Marvin's statement, which was leaked to me, also, I mean, it's up there online at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll put it up again this week. I mean, because it is quite, I think, you know, when we elect politicians, we just need to make sure they're actually doing what they say they're doing, and they've done what they say they've done. Because one of the things that Marvin says in his statement is that he's proud to have secured the future of all of Bristol's libraries. Well, most people in the city would argue that he tried to close the libraries, and it's actually only campaigning by other councillors, other parties, that those libraries stayed open, Nicola.
Now, that's an example of democracy in action, Tony. But, you know, it wasn't Marvin who decided to give himself a pay rise. It was actually a full council meeting that was held just before the complete lockdown. So I just wanted to raise that as a
okay point. Yeah, and also I mean, the other thing, of course, is that this lockdown was it before, yeah, but the question is, was it before or after the decision to extend the or to cancel the elections and to extend everyone's tenure for another year?
I think it was made before the decision to postpone the election, because I think that happened afterwards. So I think, you know, people started talking about only having meetings if they were absolutely necessary, but we didn't realise what the full picture looked like. So it's right. We've got further into it that we've realised, actually, we can't do this, we can't do this, and that's what's happened.
So, I mean, essentially, the decision was made on the basis that it would be a newly elected mayor, but then within a couple of weeks or so, maybe a week even, the decision was made to cancel the elections for a year and postpone them for a year. But also in Marvin's statement, he says that he's fully funded a £40 million council tax reduction scheme. Well, Mark Wright from the Lib Dems pointed out that that also wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for very strong campaigning from other parties, the Lib Dems in particular, to make sure that the council tax reduction scheme carried on. I mean, this is one of the incredible things about this is that
I think it was the Labour Party that were really clear on the council tax reduction scheme. It wasn't, you know, Bristol Council or the Bristol Labour Party who decided to postpone the election. It was the national government. So we can't take the credit for that sensible decision as much as we'd like to. But I certainly don't think it was the Lib Dems who were behind.
We'd
like to take credit for a lot of the good work that the Labour Party does.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, Mayor Marvin Rees is not the Labour Party, even though he represents the Labour Party. Some of the decisions that he makes, there is a little bit of kickback from the party itself, obviously. Another thing that Marvin talked about in his re-election statement was investing £90 million in tackling fuel poverty. Well, of course, quite a lot of that has gone into this, well, many would call a dead duck company called Bristol Energy, which the council just seems to be throwing more and more money into, good money after bad. What's your thoughts about Bristol Energy and, you know, whether that's actually good value for money for council taxpayers?
Well, Bristol Energy was started by the Lib Dems, and actually we're in a position now where we're saying we need to look at whether it's feasible, but we need to study the evidence to make decisions and not go with our sort of how we feel. So that's where we are at the moment. But, you know, we are spending money at the moment to help us with this coronavirus and the impact it has on people. We're going to have to completely review the council's expenditure at some point. We have been promised money from central government. I don't know how that's going to trickle through. But all the things that were promised before the coronavirus outbreak, they all need to be looked at again. You can't be held to promises you made, because it's a new world we're living in now and we need to respond appropriately. And I think the Labour councillors will be really responsible in taking all those things into account.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up, because Marvin Rees has said we need an extra £60 million from central government to pay for the policies which central government have brought in with the virus. The big news this week, Nicola, is that we've seen the resignation of Neil Ferguson from Imperial College, the guy that did the modelling, which really changed the decision. OK, so initially Boris Johnson said was going for a more of a Sweden approach, where you allow your young people to catch the disease. You don't have such a strict lockdown. And it was Neil Ferguson's Imperial College report that convinced the cabinet to go for having a lockdown. Now, he this week has been sacked for actually not apparently, anyway, not even believing in his own report, because he had a married woman come over to his house twice to break the lockdown conditions. Anyway, what do you make of this policy, central government policy? It does now seem that even the person that convinced the cabinet to go for the lockdown didn't really believe in it himself.
It's really interesting, Tony, because you've been talking about all these conspiracy theories that relate to the VE celebrations. And if you look at how poorly our government is behaving now, it makes you wonder what went on all those years ago. I mean, I wouldn't trust anything that comes out of a Tory MP's mouth. And I'm disgusted at watching them on the telly every single day when we've got nurses and doctors who are dying because they haven't got the resources they want to care for the people that need to be cared for. It's absolutely hideous. And people voted for the Conservative Party in December expecting them to take care of us. Well, they haven't. And we've just seen a complete load of lies and exaggerations by the Conservative government. So I'm absolutely appalled by it. And I hope people really do start to think about what they're voting for in general elections, because we got the highest death rate in Europe, you know, and it's just not acceptable. People voted for that, though. They voted in December. So the council stands to lose £80 million from loss of income, and that's from council tax, rents and parking charges. Now, somehow we have got to make that money, recoup that money in some way. And I think Marvin's absolutely right in holding national government to account, because he wants some money off them. We shouldn't be paying for that. It should be coming from somewhere.
Sorry, I said it was 60 million. You're telling me it's actually 80 million. That, I mean, this is, this is the relationship with Westminster. I mean, you're having to do what Westminster says, but then they're saying, well, you're going to have to find the money to cope with it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting, because so much was promised at the beginning that, you know, you wonder actually what, if that's going to still be available. It's easy to promise things and it's different to deliver. And we haven't seen much delivery on anything, on testing, on uniforms, or, you know, so I can't see it's going to be any different with money.
No. Okay. So, I mean, it does seem as if the government hasn't really thought this policy through. Let's come back to Neil Ferguson and his resignation, because this is almost a kind of grenade going off at the middle of the lockdown policy. Can we be certain that this policy is the right policy when the guy behind it didn't believe it in himself and has now been sacked?
Look, I think this is the science that we need to think about and not the scientist. I mean, when you look at all the policies that were in the newspaper the day after this was discovered, it was the Sun newspaper called it something like trousers down. I mean, they use that headline for everybody that gets caught out. At the end of the day, we're people and, you know, he was in a position, he should set a good example. We're all finding this difficult, I think, this lockdown, but just because he's been caught in this compromising position, it doesn't mean the scientific facts that he's been presenting to us aren't accurate. We do need to think about that.
Okay, well, we'll be talking a bit more about some of those and maybe what you might call conspiracy theories. I would say necessarily actually we need a good broad selection of opinions, particularly from scientists and from emergency doctors, which we'll be hearing from later, because the science doesn't seem to be being teased out properly by the London press for us at all. Anyway, let's go back to talking about the funding shortfall for cities like Bristol, the idea that council taxpayers are effectively being told they've got to bail out central government's decisions, even though people haven't necessarily got any money to pay that council tax. It does seem as if this is really an attack on local democracy, an attack on local government, an attack on Bristol, an attack on Marvin Rees and all of our councillors who are trying to make ends meet in the city. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week, where we hear about the city funding shortfall across the country.
We now come to the final question from Lillian Greenwood. Lillian Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Community Secretary has rightly recognised that council workers are the unsung heroes of this crisis and promised to give local authorities the resources they need. But my city faces a gap of up to £55 million as a result of extra costs and lost income. Our communities bore the brunt of austerity. They cannot carry the burden of coronavirus. Will he give all councils a cast iron guarantee that they won't be asked to do so?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank her very much, and she's absolutely right, as anybody knows, to draw attention to the difficulties, the straitened circumstances, the pressures that local councils have been under. And that's why we put the extra £3.2 billion in immediately to help them cope. And she should know, by the way, that Nottingham, her own city, has already had an extra £19 million to help deal with the pressures of coronavirus. And certainly that is by no means the last of the support that we will be giving to our fantastic frontline council workers who, as she rightly says, have borne so much of the brunt in this crisis.
Well, £3.2 billion, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister's mentioning there, is first Prime Minister's questions facing the new Labour leader Keir Starmer, Nicola. Have we seen any of that £3.2 billion in Bristol yet?
Yeah, I think it's about 25 million. But, you know, what we're doing is we're getting money for extra costs, but we're not getting any money to replace the income that we've lost. And that's really important.
Well, OK, so he's saying that there's going to be more coming down the line. Let's keep a watching brief on that. Do you think we can trust Boris?
No. That's the polite version of my answer.
Let's just bring Martin Summers in here, because there is a serious problem with council finances, Martin. I think it's, you know, it almost seems as if this is surreptitiously or maybe just by neglect an attempt to neuter city councils and to literally bankrupt them.
Well, I think the problems are objective, as Nicola's just pointed out. It's not so much the expenditure side, although that's obviously a problem. It's the income side of councils is also being cut to pieces as the economic shock of coronavirus gets going. It's hardly started yet. It's going to roll through the economy. And ultimately, a crisis like this, the only real answer is for the state, nationally and locally, to take command of the economy. The private sector is about to collapse. But of course, the Tory government doesn't believe in that. They've ended up doing it because there's no other option, but they don't actually believe in it. And we're going to see tensions developing as we go forward between the right-wing ideology of the government that the private sector should be doing things and the reality that in a situation like this, it can't. And of course, you might see a change. I mean, Boris is such an ideological chameleon. He could decide that he's going to be the Tory that's in favour of big government, as he's previously mused. He could be a Brexity Hezer, Brexity Heseltine. But of course, in actual fact, his party is wedded to the bailout, for example, of the financial services sector, which should just be allowed to collapse now. In the US, they've bailed out the banks again and all the major corporations. They should have nationalised them, not bailed them out. And I mean, the same issues are going to rise here.
What we've been hearing from Nottingham and from Nicola here and from Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees is that potentially we could be looking at the virus outbreak as an excuse or reason to massively diminish the power of local government and the democracy that we all vote for every year.
They've been war with local government for years. And, of course, they're now forced to come up with some kind of money for an emergency situation. But of course, what really needs is a complete rebalancing of the fiscal state. So we should go back to land-based taxation for local authorities. Things like the rates, for example, which are still there in Northern Ireland because they didn't dare to remove them in the 1980s. We're going to need wealth taxes. You can't just run everything on deficits, although deficits are fine. The idea that we can't have a deficit, we've just proved that you can. I think the Tories have just thrown their own textbook out of the window and said, oh, yes, we can spend money when we want to, which was always true. But, of course, ultimately, you can't just spend money. You've got to raise it as well. And the obvious place to raise it from is from the financial services sector that was bailed out in 2008 and is being bailed out now. Ultimately, you bail out the people and allow the financial services sector to collapse. Though, ultimately, looking forward, you could see a situation where you have essentially the financial services sector run as a public utility and the modern, what we thought of as modern financial services just disappears. Now, the Tories are going to have to face into this abyss. They're not going to do the right thing. I'm pretty certain they aren't. But nevertheless, that is the choices that they face.
We're going to look now at Sunday's coming announcement in 2 days' time of what the route out of lockdown is likely to look like. Very difficult to predict. But we 2 weeks ago on this programme, there was a traffic light report which was leaked to the Daily Mirror and one or two other newspapers where they're saying that there's going to be a red phase, an amber phase and a green phase in the relaxing of the lockdown over the next few months. So that suggested 2 weeks ago, which we covered on this programme, the red phase, which it predicted for the 11th of May, which, of course, is the bank holiday Monday just coming. Small non-residential shops can reopen, it said. Hairdressers can reopen, thank God. Lucky we're not on video today because we could all compare each other's dreadful haircuts or lack of haircuts. Warehouses apparently are going to reopen again, although I'm quite certain many of them already have. You can see on industrial estates, there's quite a lot of lorries back on the roads going across the channel, etc. Nurseries are officially allowed to reopen again, and travel will be possible but discouraged. That seems to me to be pretty much what's going on at the moment. I had to make a trip, an essential trip to London yesterday to visit very elderly relatives, and that was quite interesting to see on the motorway. I would say roughly something like a third of the normal traffic. Definitely people seem to be coming back out onto the roads and onto the streets and into the parks, etc. Lots of very busy parks in London, the weather being particularly nice as well. But it does seem as if this is maybe the thing which is going to be announced on Sunday with the relaxation on the 11th of May into the red phase. Then apparently on the 25th of May, there may be an amber phase. And obviously the dates here are flexible. Boris can choose them. Small businesses will open up up to 50 staff, social distancing. Some of those measures are lifted. I'll put a link up to the graphic, which was produced on the Mirror by the Mirror 2 weeks ago. And then a green phase on the 15th of June. Weddings and funerals can then take place with more guests. Theatres and cinemas will open with social distancing. Pubs will open with restrictions on the 15th of June. So we'll see if that is what they stick to. I mean, if this programme is what they stick to, it does rather make you wonder why they couldn't have told us all this 2 weeks ago. But let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week. The first one, where Keir Starmer was facing Boris Johnson, the new Labour leader, facing the Tory leader back after his spell in hospital and his paternity leave. And Starmer asks Boris this week about what he thinks life after lockdown is going to be like. Are we prepared?
Keir Starmer again.
Mr Speaker, I was going to come to the plan. I'm grateful to the Prime Minister for that indication. There are millions of people on furlough, as the Prime Minister knows, millions with children at home struggling with caring responsibilities. If they're to return to work, and if their children are to return to school, they need reassurance. I think we can all feel that, reassurance that it'll be safe to do so. And that means they do need to know what the government's plan is for the next stage. So will the Prime Minister give him that reassurance by setting out his plan as he says he will? Or will he come to this House on Monday to present that plan and have questions across the House?
Mr Speaker, I will of course undertake that there will be a statement to the House as you, Mr Speaker, and the House would properly expect about what we propose tonight. So I just want to explain to the House as a courtesy why it's happening on Sunday, Mr Speaker. I'm sure you'd be interested to know that. The reason for that is very simple, that we have to be sure that the data is going to support our ability to do this. That data is coming in continuously over the next few days. We'll want, if we possibly can, to get going with some of these measures on Monday. I think it would be a good thing, Mr Speaker, if people had an idea of what's coming the following day. That's why I think Sunday, the weekend, is the best time to do it. But of course, the House will be fully informed and the House will have the full opportunity to debate and interrogate me or the government on that matter.
And hopefully in the future it will be to the House first.
Yeah, so a statement to House of Commons on Monday and a discussion about the way that the lockdown is apparently the first stage to relaxing things a little bit. But Nicola, he's talking there. He's saying, well, actually, we're going to be having a very close look at the statistics up until Sunday. So we know that what we announced for Monday is going to be the right thing to do. But there are quite a lot of questions about the statistics, the death rate statistics that have been coming through. And it's quite clear that the more that gets tested, the more people will be testing positive for COVID-19.
Yeah. I mean, I never thought that Boris Johnson was fit enough to lead the country anyway. But, you know, we've got a man who's not really very well, and I don't think he's in a position to be doing what he's doing at the moment. And I really don't think that they're making very good decisions. I don't think they're in anybody's interest. We've got over 500 people dying daily from this virus, and we're not in a position to relax any of the rules. We're not testing people properly. We still haven't got proper equipment. You know, we can't make decisions to send children back to school.
Hang on, Nicola, because you just said 500 people a day dying of this virus. Well, most clinicians would argue, actually, no, they're not dying of COVID-19. They're dying with COVID-19. So it's a contributing factor. And the statistics aren't incredibly clear, but they're saying roughly around about 75%, possibly 80% of those that are dying have got underlying health conditions where actually COVID-19 hasn't killed them, but it's tipped them over the edge. So there is quite an important distinction there, I think.
I don't know. If it was a relative of yours that had died, you know, would you really be asking about the distinction? So we've got people dying. The rest of us have been isolating. I don't think it's the right time to send people back to work. We don't really understand enough about this virus as well. I mean, at the moment, we've got double the death rate. That's what we're dealing with, double the normal death rate. So do we do nothing and continue to allow people to die, or do we do something about it? We haven't sort of conquered how we manage the virus, and already we're talking about meeting the needs of the economy. Now, I think people need to come before the needs of the economy, and, you know, we'll sort that out later.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about the increased death rate, but not all of those people have been dying with the virus. There's quite a lot of extra people have been dying as well with no coronavirus symptoms at all. So let's have a look at that in a little while. But let's stay on the economic factors for a minute. And another thing that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week was the idea of universal credit or a universal basic income taking up millions more people's incomes, ensuring that people don't starve, that you know, rents can be paid, electricity bills can be paid, and that sort of thing. So let's have a listen to that question now.
We go across to Murray Black. Murray Black.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Since the government are refusing to even discuss universal basic income, I was glad to see them at least recognise the need for an increase in universal credit entitlement. However, there's been no such increase announced in employment support allowance. So I want to ask the Prime Minister what plans he has for a similar increase in ESA, and if not, can he explain why he feels people who are sick or have a disability require less support at this time?
Prime Minister.
As she knows, what we have done is remove the 7-day waiting time for ESA, and I'm glad, though, that she pays tribute to the big increase in universal credit, another £1,040, benefiting 4 million families across this country, a total investment of £7 billion. But I think what everybody wants to see is not just people taking universal credit, but as I've said now several times, what they want to see is a careful, sensible programme attracting the widest possible support to continue to suppress the disease right down, but to allow our economy to start up again.
Well, that's Prime Minister Boris Johnson responding to a question about whether people on very low incomes and people who have had their livelihoods taken away are going to be able to survive. Martin, this whole idea of a universal basic income has been talked about for a long time. Do you think that this might be something to tip the government towards doing that? Or do you think the resistance is too much? They just don't like the idea that people will have the basic things that they need in life, the fundamental human needs satisfied.
Well, if we brought in a universal basic income in response to the financial crisis of 2008, we would have been in a much better position to deal with this coronavirus shock. And of course, the other thing about the coronavirus shock people got to realise is that the financial sector was collapsing in the United States in September before the coronavirus came along, and the Federal Reserve was already intervening in the repo market. Now, in other words, the financial crisis was going to happen anyway. The coronavirus has simply created a cover for the bailout of the banking system for the second time. And it's an unending, it's an unlimited bailout in the US. The Federal Reserve, which doesn't actually have the constitutional right to do this, but everybody's just waved it through, are now saying they'll print any amount of money to keep the financial services sector afloat. That is all basically based on the idea that the taxpayers will pick up the tab in the future. This shock, coronavirus plus economic shock, is the biggest since World War II, and there's going to have to be big thinking to deal with the consequences.
Well, Nicola,
things like universal basic income, definitely. But
Nicola,
the Tories are basically on the back foot on this one because they've tried to avoid all of this for years.
Nicola, councillors and MPs are actually in many ways on the front line when people are actually up against it, facing potential bankruptcy, eviction, and the rather, it seems, inadequate government response to that. What's your sense for what's going on in the city now with people on low incomes and those who are, you know, did have a reasonably safe income, particularly self-employed owners of small businesses, that are now finding that they need to sign on the dole, and that their plans they've made for the future, for their income, for their kids, for their family, etc., is in tatters?
I think it's a big concern, and I think, as Martin said, there needs to be some really big thinking around this. You know, people were struggling before, and people are still affected by benefit caps, for example. You know, the most vulnerable are going to be the most affected. We know that. But it's interesting that the clip that you showed just a minute ago, the last thing that Boris Johnson says is our economy must start up again. That's all he's interested in.
So that for small businesses, this is a serious problem. For many small businesses have found it impossible to actually get these so-called loans. I mean, one is amazed that the government has the audacity to give people loans in this sort of situation. Of course, they should be giving grants to businesses to carry on, since the government is responsible for their lack of income in a similar way to with the council. The former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King was on Newsnight this week talking about this particular problem that he's identified. He's very much in touch with people like the Federation of Small Businesses, etc. And they're saying that it's becoming, for many businesses, it's been totally impossible to access this money that the government say is there in order to keep them going. So let's have a listen to the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King now.
The government's done its very best to come up with a scheme to help small businesses and the self-employed. But it doesn't seem to be the case that the businesses that need the money find it easy to speak to the banks and ask for loans under this scheme. They wouldn't be asking for loans under this scheme if it weren't for the virus. So I think, in a sense, the banks now need to act as agents for the government. This is a government scheme. If that means the government guaranteeing a higher proportion of the loan, so be it. But one way or another, the banks need to be able to put out more loans. And if it's not working, someone needs to get a grip on it.
So that's the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King speaking on Newsnight, suggesting there, Martin, that the government hasn't got a grip on this scheme, although it's talking the talk about supporting small businesses, making sure that they can survive through this government-imposed lockdown. They're not walking the walk.
Well, the obvious thing to point out is, why are the banks distributing the loans? The government could distribute the loans directly to small business. Cut out the banks. Why do you need the middlemen of the banks? But of course, we need the middlemen of the banks because that's the way the thinking goes. We have to have banks, and therefore we've got to work through the banks to work with small business.
The government could take that over for itself. If I can interrupt you, I think what Mervyn King is suggesting there is that the government are failing at the job, so we need to find another route that might possibly be the banks doing these loans directly.
No, the scheme as it stands, Tony, is that the government will underwrite loans from the banks, so that then the banks are supposed to administer the scheme. The government could take control of this scheme itself and cut out the banks. The whole idea that the banks have got to be involved is a Tory thing.
Nicola, what do you got to say to anyone with small businesses, shops, etc., self-employed, that are really desperate for loans or grants in order to keep going because they're going to fold up? I mean, this is another aspect to all of this, isn't it? Big business is doing very well out of all of this. We've got lots of extremely powerful transnational companies, the likes of Amazon, people like that, are having a field day, massive increase in profits, in revenues, and yet the small people, small, medium enterprises are being really hard hit by this. What have you got to say to them?
It's a real worry, and I'm really worried about this because, you know, you're talking about people that we live with, people that we know, our friends, etc. And I think the government really does need to step in and do something about this. But I think the role of the banks in this is to devolve any blame from the shoulders of the government, so there's someone to blame. But, you know, we have a responsibility to help retail, pubs, restaurants, et cetera, and we need to shop and spend our money as responsibly as we can to support them. So we all need to come together and think about how we're going to support SMEs in the future. Otherwise, we could end up with a situation where parts of Bristol and the rest of the country become ghost towns, and we don't want that. So we all have a role to play, I think, in moving forward. But the government are the people that need to step in and support SMEs, not expect someone else to take on that role, because it's no one else's responsibility.
So we've also got, I mean, one of the things, particularly, Nicola, reason I asked you on is because you're a primary mental health specialist as a day job. Can you just tell us a bit about, you know, what that means, what you do?
I'm a primary mental health specialist, so I work with children and families where there are mental health worries to try and look at finding solutions to some of the problems that people have.
Without naming names, just give us an example of the you know, sort of interaction that you might have with a family and who you're actually working for.
So I'm employed by the National Health Service, and I work for children's social care.
So just give us an idea of you know, so a typical, well, not a typical day, but you know, the sort of way you can help, what outcome you might get for a family.
So, for example, there are lots of concerns about how children reintegrate into school. So we might be working with schools to think about how they can start to re-engage children in a way that's not going to cause them any emotional harm. So that might be one of the ways I engage.
Well, emotional harm, of course, that's something that the church used to deal with years ago. I suppose if you people felt that they were having problems emotionally, that they would go and talk to the local vicar. Now, it's mental health specialists like you they speak to. Do you think that's fair to say that you're doing a job which maybe a century ago would have been done by the church?
Well, the church did a lot of things a century ago that it doesn't do today, although I think the role of the church is changing. In Bristol, it does quite a lot. But, you know, we lived in different communities 100 years ago, and that was before Margaret Thatcher and the Tories came along and tried to break up the communities that we lived in. So, you know, I think a lot of things have happened in the way that we changed the way that we live that have an impact on mental health.
I mean, I think as many people, you know, if someone had a mental health condition before the lockdown, it's likely to be exacerbated during and after it. But let's go back to...
Really, no? Tony.
What do you think, Nicola?
If you've got a mental health problem where it's easier to stay inside your house, then the lockdown might be easier for you to manage. So for some people, this might be, you know, you have to rethink sort of whole spectrum of mental health, really. It's not about one size fits all, because some people will find it easier to live during the lockdown than other people will.
But I mean, it's effectively, I mean, you can't help but compare it to Julian Assange and his house arrest. I mean, this is a form of house arrest, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of people, particularly if they're isolated and lonely, that this could tip them over the edge.
Yeah, there is that. And that's a concern that, you know, And we need to think about how we support people to make connections with other people, even though they're isolated and living in their homes.
Well, look, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions. Another emotional, I suppose, related, mental health possibly related story, and that is to do with burial services. And this question is particularly difficult for those who've lost loved ones and possibly not been able to see them on their deathbeds, then finding almost like a double whammy where there are all sorts of restrictions on burial services too. So let's have a listen to that question now.
We'll go across to Remanchisti.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like other colleagues, I'm absolutely delighted to see the Prime Minister back at the dispatch box and congratulating him and Carrie on the birth of their child. Prime Minister, my constituent, Jackie Potter, recently lost her husband, Ashley, who was 64. The family would like to bury Ashley with a small church service, applying social distancing. If Ashley were to be cremated, this would happen. But as he is being buried under current guidelines, that is not possible. Can this anomaly between burials and cremations be urgently addressed so that families of all faiths who want to bury their loved ones, applying social distancing and in a faith service, are able to do so?
Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. And I thank my honourable friends and I extend my deepest sympathies to the friends and family of his constituent Ashley, and we're asking councils to do exactly that, to help people to attend without breaching the rules on social distancing. I'm sure you'd appreciate we think that's the right balance to strike.
So Boris Johnson there saying that there may be some sort of opening up of these services of some kind. Anyway, what are your thoughts, Nicola, about the emotions around something like losing a loved one and then having to cope with a whole load of what some people say are draconian measures, where they're quite prepared to do, say, an activity like a funeral service, a burial service, using social distancing, but being told, for example, that if it's a cremation, it can go ahead. If it's a burial, it can't.
I mean, losing a lost one can be, you know, one of the most difficult experiences that somebody goes through in their whole life. And sort of over time, we've developed a cultural way of getting through that. And now that's all changed. And we haven't really been given the opportunity to think about how we do that whole process differently. And I've seen some, you know, services online that people have attended. I think it's really sad. And, you know, we are talking about relaxing some of the rules. And I think that needs to be one of the rules that we think about, because not being able to grieve appropriately is, you know, not an acceptable form in terms of supporting people to get through this and, you know, deal with losing loved ones.
Yes, and also, I mean, funerals, to a certain extent, I've been to some that can be a kind of celebration of somebody's life.
Well, you know, people have really creative ways of expressing how they want to say goodbye or, you know, commemorate someone's life. There's lots of different ways that we go through this process. And, you know, I don't think the thinking has sort of really included a lot of things around that.
No, and also, I mean, humans characterise themselves as different to other creatures by actually making a big thing of this, and think we've done that throughout history. It's one of the things that anthropologists talk about. And now it's, for many people, it's been taken away. But before we get completely off this subject, there was an interview on the BBC's PM programme this week with the head of the Public Health Institute at Newcastle University, Alison Pollock, Professor Alison Pollock, talking about isolating the dying and elderly and the effect. She talks about it as a barbaric practice.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is barbaric. I mean, we've talked for years about how we treat our elderly. You know, it's BE Day plus 75 years today, and we're saying what a wonderful thing those people did. And I don't think that we are really acknowledging that in our everyday experiences. I've had people contact me to help to put some sort of hygiene standards into care homes and things. They shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to organise ourselves to look after people. So, you know, and we accept that elderly people are at risk of being isolated, and that's in our normal society. So how are those people going to feel now that we've got social distancing, people are frightened to go out? I would agree with what Alison Pollock's saying.
Well, let's have a listen to her now on on the PM programme on Radio 4 earlier this week.
There was an admission today of how tough it is for the extremely vulnerable to carry on shielding themselves, staying at home, often alone. Yeah. I mean, can people continue to do that without suffering ill effects, be that in terms of their mental health or their physical health?
Yes, I think this is an enormous hardship for everybody, but especially older people who may not have very much longer to live in their lives. And so, indeed, nursing homes now should be making arrangements so that you can have at least one member of the family visiting. I mean, that would be good for the individual, and there should be a designated member, and that's beginning to happen, for example, in New Zealand. I think this idea of people being in solitary confinement, which is like prison, and also dying on their own is inhumane and it's barbaric, and we've never had anything like this before in this country. It's really for this sort of epidemic, it's really quite barbaric.
So that's Professor Alison Pollock from Newcastle University, Martin, saying the idea of saying that there are rules now that if people are dying, that they are not allowed to see their family. This is the first time it's ever happened, according to Alison.
Well, I mean, as Nicola pointed out, we've been isolating old people anyway before all of this kicked in. There's been a problem with isolation and so on. I think as this goes on, we're going to have to develop rules to deal with these situations, and we're going to have to tweak them till we're satisfied with them, or probably will never be satisfied with them, because I don't see that this is going to end anytime soon. The idea that we've got in the Tory press that we're going to be going back to boom, boom Britain and getting Brexit done, I think that's for history. We're not going back to any of that.
So let's have a listen now to some, I suppose, what you might call conspiracy theories, Nicola. But this is doctors over in California. And I brought this clip in really because of Press Freedom Day last weekend, because their interviews, the press conference these emergency doctors did in the United States in California, was then removed from YouTube. Now, I can only assume that one of the big TV networks who filmed the press conference decided to take a claim to remove it. But anyway, what they're saying is actually really, I think, very important when it comes to understanding some of the facts and figures to do with the science behind the lockdown, and also hearing from people who are actually on the front line, emergency running, as I understand it, a private emergency clinic in California. So let's hear from Dan Erickson now, and he's talking about how the lockdown he doesn't believe it's actually really affected the death rate a great deal. And this is from 2 weeks ago in California. Let's hear from him now.
Who has done lockdown and who has not done lockdown, and has it mattered?
Yeah.
So when I look at the data globally, I look at Sweden and I look at California, New York, and the U.S., and I say one locked down and one didn't. One right. Let it run its course and one didn't. And has that affected the death rate? And the death rate has really been 150 per million for the United States and 200 per million for Sweden. Italy and Spain have 400 per million, and they locked down, which means their death rate was higher. And there's a variety of factors for that. I don't want to simplify, but what I'm saying is sheltering in place and locking down was supposed to, the point of it was to not overwhelm our hospital systems. Well, in Kern County, our hospital census is very low. As I talk to the CEOs, their ICUs have very few patients. Their ERs don't have patients. They have many beds open, and we're saying, okay, for 2 months, we sheltered, we locked down, we did what was required. Now I think it's appropriate to start easing up and allowing the medical system to bring all of its people back and function at a normal level, because it doesn't make sense to send doctors and nurses home.
Well, so he's finishing. That's Dan Erickson, doctor in California there. Obviously, this is the figures and for California. But he's also saying, and we'll hear again another clip now, and we can comment on it afterwards, where he's saying here that he believes actual infection rates of the virus are 65 times higher than the official figures in the United States. So it looks as if, and there could be a similar thing going on here, where many, many people have got the virus over the last few months and it simply hasn't been detected. So let's have a listen again to Dan Erickson talking about infection rates, the ones he found through testing himself and the official government figures, and the anomaly between the two.
The CDC requested us to use a screening of cough, fever, shortness of breath, which is what we did. And right now, we've done just under 6,000 tests, and we're getting about a 7% positive infection rate for COVID for Kern County, which has just under a million people. Our study was initially not randomized, meaning we were selecting who we were going to test. And then after a few weeks of that, we had a lot of people coming in who were requesting the test for a variety of reasons. And we had employers who said, hey, I need my employees tested to come back to work. So we started really testing everyone who needed a test. And so our numbers really started to climb. Initially it was 6.5. Now it's 7%. So I'm reporting my data and comparing it to, for instance, Stanford. They're doing antibody testing in Santa Clara County, and they're seeing between 2.5 and 4.16% positive rate, which means that they have between 45 and 80,000 cases. Well, their health department reported 956. So this is 50 to 80 times the amount of positive cases in Santa Clara County. In Kern County as well, the amount reported is fairly low, and we're getting about a 7% positive rate. So the numbers are likely much higher in those two counties than was anticipated by the numbers at Public Health.
So that's Dr. Dan Erickson there, censored from YouTube. One does wonder what's going on. We can't hear him on the London media, the mass media, and now we can't even hear him on YouTube, on social media. Why is his voice being censored, one wonders, and it may be simply because what he's saying there, Nicola, and I'm not asking you to necessarily come up with an opinion on whether what he's saying is right or not, but he's suggesting that the actual infection rates from the virus may be 65 times higher than the official figures in the US. And I just wonder that, I mean, this is not just one order of magnitude, is it? It's almost two orders of magnitude completely wrong. And yet decisions are being made by central government in the US and in Britain based on these, what you might call lies, damn lies and statistics.
I know. I mean, we've got no way at the moment of really knowing how many people have been affected. And I understand there's not a reliable antibody test available either. So, you know, it's going to be a really long time before we've got any idea about how many people have really been affected by it. And I just say something about the other point about social isolation, because there was with Sweden. But, you know, Sweden's had recorded deaths of about 3,000, and neighbouring countries, Norway and Finland, well, Finland's about 255 and Norway's 217. That's quite a big difference. So I think there is an awful lot of evidence to suggest that social isolation is working. And, you know, we are using really crude screening tools like fever, cough, shortness and breath. Until we get a real understanding of who's been affected, we're not going to have any other helpful ways of dealing with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the basic things with the statistics is I would only take into consideration statistics that are looked at per measure of population. I mean, the idea of what is the total number of people who've died in one country doesn't mean anything compared to another country unless you're looking at it as a percentage of the population. I mean, obviously, more people have died in the US because it's bigger. You know, this is a real basic thing that many journalists don't seem to be even bothering with. But Martin, what do you make of what we were hearing there from the US, this censored clip from Dan Erickson, the doctor in California, saying that he believes from the actual tests he's done himself that the official figures in the United States, there's actually 65 times more people have had this virus than the official figures suggest.
Well, in South Korea, of course, they tested everybody and they've got a fairly good idea of who's got the virus, who hasn't got it. They tested people at random and they chased people up when they found that they were infected. What you've got in the US with a shambolic system is that they've no idea how many people have been affected. And of course, it raises the question that perhaps this thing didn't start in China at all, and it's been running around in the US for months. That's possibly something we can discuss in hour two.
And let's just look at the figures, the death rate figures per head of population, which I think is the thing that really makes sense.
Can I just make a point on that, Tony? Don't forget that the virus spread. Some countries are not in the direct path of the virus. So it's not just a question of per head of population, it's per head of the people, numbers of people infected, yeah?
And also, of course, some countries are, it seems, far ahead, many weeks or even months ahead of other countries, and they don't want to admit it. So they're saying that they're at the same stage of the virus, but they're not. Anyway, let's have a look at the death figures at the moment per head of population. This is, I pulled these figures out a couple of days ago. The highest in Europe is Belarus with 2,000 per million of actually died, which is 0.2% of the population with coronavirus. In Belgium, the figure is very high. It's 690 per million. In Spain, it's 550. Italy, 480 people have died with COVID-19. The statistics say that Britain comes just below Italy, Spain, Belgium, Belarus. At 420 people per million of population have died with COVID-19 on their death certificates. In France, it's 420 below Britain per million. Then comes Sweden at 280 per million, which is 0.03% of the population. Now, you know, once we start getting down to 400, 300 per million of population, this is starting to look much more like a very severe flu season. Germany has done the best of all, though. Whether it's to do with managing their statistics or whether it's their incredibly efficient healthcare system is anyone's guess. But the German figures are 100 people per million of population have died with coronavirus. So that is 0.01% in Germany have died. So the figures there, Martin, and I'm afraid we've just lost Nicola Bowden-Jones now. But what do you make of all these figures here?
Well, I think we've got to take all of the figures with a pinch of salt, because, of course, the reporting of these figures is different in each country.
But hang on, Martin, you can't take them with a pinch. The government is using these figures to decide what it's going to do on Monday and whether it's
going to... Listen, we've got to use the figures because you haven't got anything else to use. But you've got to recognise that the figures themselves are very much a rough estimate of what's going on. I mean, different countries have got quite different ways of reporting these things. And that, you know, you can't presume that one country's way of connecting the figures is comparable with another.
And we
doesn't
hearing
mean
from
we
the
can't
United
draw
States.
Some broad conclusions from what we're reading and what we're seeing.
But we were hearing
we
from
to
the
recognize
United States.
Still, it's still figures, tentative.
We were hearing from the United States earlier, the figures there in one emergency doctor's surgery and the testing that he was personally doing, 85% more than actually the official government figures in the United States. So these are wildly inaccurate.
Well, they could be wildly inaccurate. This is the point I'm making. We're looking at them now, and the government's having to make decisions on the basis of what's in front of them. But of course, we're essentially flying blind because this virus has to some extent taken people by surprise. And we can't presume that we know what it is. It's not a flu virus, clearly, for a start. So comparing it with flu really doesn't make much sense. So I think we've all got to keep recognise how provisional our knowledge is in these circumstances.
And what
we
about
can draw some conclusions,
yeah,
but
right.
We've got
what
to recognise what we know.
What about developing nations? They may not.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, you've got this virus is now spreading all over the world, and in some countries. There's no mechanism for measuring these kind of statistics at all. There's no proper healthcare system, so nobody really knows who's dying or how many of them. It's only developed countries which have got some kind of healthcare system which collect these kind of statistics effectively. And of course, the US, although it is a developed country, has got an absolutely chaotic, fragmented healthcare system. Where the chances of them actually being able to cope with the situation are quite limited compared, for example, to Sweden, which has got a very highly developed healthcare system and collects statistics probably as effectively as anybody can.
I mean, what
and
they're
I
saying
think it's interesting
in
Germany
Sweden.
Done so well, because again, they didn't go for herd immunity. They went for lockdown and tracing. Tracing is the key to it. They didn't go for a full lockdown in South Korea. They traced everybody. And then they know exactly how many people they've got. And even in China, they've now reached the point where they're not getting any more infections. Unless, of course, the lockdown may change that.
A very important matter, Martin, which is that some countries like the US and the UK, we've just heard this week that also France, there were cases of COVID-19 there well before even the outbreak was reported in China, that some countries may be much further into the spread of the disease than they realise, having had it spread even for months in their country before COVID-19 was even recognised.
Well, I think there's going to have to be an investigation into all of this about how it all started. And as you know, Tony, there's already recriminations going on with Pompeo and the Trump regime, if we can call it that, trying to pin the virus on the Wuhan Virological Laboratory via the Murdoch press, where then the intelligence services in the West, the Five Eyes, came forward and said, well, that's nothing to do with us. This is the Trump administration's, special advisors that have come up with this. And, of course, it was also, as Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister, pointed out today, this is a leaked report, and therefore it is, in fact, illegal to be leaked. And it's been picked up by Murdoch's Australian Telegraph and so on. But in actual fact, what they're doing is this is a leaked report, and it's been leaked by the US administration. Now, has it been leaked deliberately? And if it's been leaked deliberately, did Trump give the orders for it to be leaked deliberately?
Well, there are lots of strategic leaks go on in our world, although the public aren't necessarily au fait as to which are actual real leaks. In fact, I tend to think that almost every time there's a leak, that somebody stands something to gain by it.
Well, exactly. I mean, it looks pretty clear that Murdoch has got together with Trump to push this so-called report, 15 pages, PDF, which links supposedly, according to the intelligence services of the West, to the Wuhan virus. But there's been pushback from the intelligence services, from MI6 and others who've been briefing The Guardian that this isn't their report. Now, in other words, we're basically, you'd have thought in a situation like this with a red crisis on, everybody would be really, really scrupulous about sticking to the facts. But in actual fact, what we've got is political spinning going on.
Well,
and of course, that then leads to questions about what this virus is.
Massive piece of political spin that's been going on is painting this idea of a vaccine as this sort of knight in shining armor charging across over the horizon to save us all from COVID-19, where actually we know that the Gates Foundation, who is pushing this virus vaccine as a solution to the virus around the world, was actually funding Neil Ferguson's department at Imperial College, which came up with the very overestimated the idea that 500,000 people in Britain were going to die of COVID-19, let alone with COVID-19. He is now being sacked. To a certain extent, that whole policy has been discredited because he wasn't actually following it or believing it himself. Although his reason, he said, was, Martin, and this goes back to what we were just talking about, that apparently he believed he had the virus and so couldn't contaminate anybody else, Neil Ferguson.
Well, I think you've got to, I mean, his personal peccadilloes have got to be extracted from the discussion. Whether he was right or not in his prognostications, you've got to remember that we have had a lockdown. What he was saying is, if we don't have a lockdown, we're going to end up with 250,000 people dead. We've had a lockdown and we've still got, what we've got. So it's easy to throw accusations around. I don't think there is going to be a vaccine. So, and if there is one, I'm going to be very suspicious.
Well, one person who would disagree with you.
It takes quite a long time to develop vaccines.
Well, I know.
And if they just turn up with one, I'm going to be very, very suspicious indeed.
It's going to be the world record, apparently. In fact, there was a leak, wasn't there, at the presidential press conference 3 weeks or so ago, where one of the journalists was overheard saying, well, everyone here has been vaccinated. I mean, they're saying now that this was just a joke, but it did seem as if he was saying it. Is it feasible that actually there has been already a vaccine developed for this?
What happened during the anthrax attacks after 9/11 was that senior US people in the establishment were all given anthrax antibodies. They were given it in advance before the anthrax attacks started. That's on the record.
So it's not impossible then that somebody somewhere has already developed this vaccine and people, elite, rich, powerful or whatever have already had it. Is that feasible?
Well, if Bill Gates does suddenly turn up with a miracle vaccine, that is the first thing that's going to cross my mind. But I have to say, just looking at it objectively, it's very difficult to develop vaccines for viruses. And if they've got one, I'll be surprised.
The other thing is, of course, we're starting to talk here now about the possibility that this is a man-made virus or not. It certainly doesn't seem to behave like the normal common cold coronaviruses.
No, I mean, this issue of whether it is or not a biological weapon is something that can be discussed. But of course, the mainstream aren't talking about that, except that they are, because the US have decided for their own political reasons that they're going to try and pin all the blame of this on China, and then they're going to sue China for damages. They're talking about $10 million for every US citizen that's died. And, of course, the Chinese are just rolling their eyes and saying,
obvious question to ask about this virus being so completely different to previous coronaviruses. And it's, if the pubs were open, all the pubs would be alive with conversation about, is this a man-made virus, Martin?
Well, I think that the lots of people around the world are asking the question, is it a man-made virus? We had GRU colonel on the show the other week, the clip of him saying that their estimation is that it is. I am definitely disposed to think that it might be, but I don't think it's a Chinese virus. Why would they do this to themselves? Don't forget that the banking system in the US was about to collapse anyway. And this virus came along in China, their political rival and economic threat. And then suddenly they're able to bail out the banking system with no questions asked. Therefore, they've got a motive for doing it. Two motives.
Okay,
mess up the Chinese Communist Party's policy. Two, to bail out the banks, both of which they've done.
Anyway, somebody that did take on this whole possibility of having a vaccine was the Health Secretary Matt Hancock this week, speaking with the Deputy Chief Medical Officer Jonathan Van Tam at a press conference about not only the possibility of a vaccine, but also one question by a journalist from the Huffington Post was asked about the threat from the so-called anti-vaxxers, which is this term given to people who are critical of the benefits of vaccines. So let's discuss that after we've heard what Matt Hancock and Jonathan Van Tam have got to say about vaccines and anti-vaxxers.
We support the development of the vaccine, and you'll have seen the Prime Minister's excellent announcement today, and then that we also do the work to ensure that people can get access to the vaccine, starting with those who are most vulnerable. On the question of whether to make it compulsory, I think that the extent of the public's reaction to following the lockdown shows that we will be able to achieve very, very high levels of vaccination without taking that step. And so you know, our task is to ensure that it is, in the first instance, we support the science as much as possible, because we can't assume there'll be a vaccine. There is no coronavirus vaccine yet for any of the existing coronaviruses, and this is uncertain science. We're proceeding on the basis that just such a huge proportion of the population are going to take this up because of the obvious benefits to individuals and their families and their communities and indeed the whole nation, that there'll be enormous demand for it as and when the science is safe to proceed.
Yes, thank you, Secretary of State. So just to stay on the vaccine question for a little longer, it is more likely than not that the first vaccines will be licensed in adults in the first instance. And therefore, one has to put some caveats around your question around children. And the other thing to say is that so far the epidemiological evidence is not showing us that there is a massive burden of disease or burden of mortality in children. It is actually completely at the other end of the scale. It is in the elderly. And so from that perspective, again, that's another caveat I'd add to your question about vaccinating children.
Right, I think we'll get back to you, Paul. Is that the scientists will get back to you.
Yeah, just one brief follow-up, Secretary of State. Do you have a message for those anti-vaxxers here and abroad when and if we do get a vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, I think there has been no greater demonstration in modern history that vaccines save lives than the need for a vaccine to save lives and to get the world going again following the outbreak of COVID-19. And we will only license a vaccine when it is both effective and safe, and when the independent regulators, if and when the independent regulators license a vaccine in this country, they will do so knowing that it is safe. And everybody should follow that. Everybody should follow that advice.
Well, that's a fascinating answer from Matt Hancock, the health secretary there, Martin, talking about the idea that the vaccine, there's no greater demonstration of the effectiveness of the vaccine than the need for the vaccine right now.
Well, I mean, that's clearly illogical, isn't it? I mean, we haven't got a vaccine, and if we had one, we'd then have to discuss whether people would take it or not. But we're not even sure of having one, are we?
It doesn't suggest that Matt Hancock has really thought this through, does it?
Well, no. And I think people can be critical of vaccine programs and the kind of pressures that are put on by pharmaceutical companies for vaccine programs to be conducted basically to make profit for the companies concerned rather than on medical need. And I think that's the issue that people need to address, is the whole process of deciding who gets. And of course, if vaccines are made compulsory, as they are often in developing countries, then the question becomes, well, who's benefiting? Who's profiting from this?
Well, I mean,
this whole crisis brings forward the whole idea that we should have medicine and health should be outside the marketplace. There should be no room for market economics in dealing with something like this.
Well, to be fair to the drug companies, they're saying, Martin, that they don't want to make profit from the vaccine.
Well, they may say that, but that's a load of rubbish. It's well known that Bill Gates has made massive profits from his investments in this area. And his not-for-profit corporations go around. He's the major funder of the World Health Organization. Now, I don't think that's acceptable, that a billionaire is the major funder of the World Health Organization. And ultimately, World Health Organization should be a public body responsible through and accountable to the public. It shouldn't be funded by private enterprise. It's just wrong. It's a public-private partnership too far. And of course, all of this then raises questions about what the hell's going on with vaccines. And I think the vaccines in principle may be helpful, but not if they're run by people who've got a vested interest or a hidden agenda.
Well, there's also a very important aspect to this, which is the Vaccine Act in the United States in the 1980s, which made it impossible for victims of vaccines, other people who have been harmed by them, to sue the drug companies. The government basically in the US said, it's okay, you can sue the government instead. And the vaccine companies making the vaccines were so important that they didn't want vaccine companies to be damaged in private lawsuits by people who had been damaged themselves by the vaccines. So this is a legal anomaly that means that vaccines, if you're killed, hurt or damaged by a vaccine, you've got no real recourse in law except against the government, not against the vaccine manufacturers.
Well, that's right. So in other words, the power of the government is being used to protect the profits of private companies, which are run for personal profit, not for the benefit of humanity. I mean, you've got all these billionaires now giving their wealth. The Duke of Westminster gave £12 million to the National Health Service as a result of COVID-19. In actual fact, that money should have been taken off him as wealth tax, so that he doesn't get to give it as a gift and go on how wonderful he is to give us the money.
The other thing is, a lot of people have commented about the attacks over the last decade against Andrew Wakefield, striking him off. He has been a long-time campaigner, believing that the government should not be vaccinating as many people as they are. He's like the classic anti-vaxxer. And so, I mean, what some of the stuff I've been reading is saying, well, we always wondered why it was that Wakefield was being attacked in this way, even though he's making very important arguments suggesting that, one of the most important things he's shown is the poisons that are actually in some of these vaccines, things like mercury. Another thing that he's exposed is the fact that multiple injections of the vaccine are being done to newborn children, even though those multiple injections haven't been tested. The individual vaccines, one by one, say the measles vaccine on its own has been tested, but it's never been tested as a multiple vaccination with five different vaccines all being injected at once. And this, I can remember going back to the Gulf War syndrome days, interviewing victims of multiple vaccinations and inoculations during the Gulf War, Martin, who came back completely broken people. Many of them died from Gulf War syndrome.
Well, all of these things need to be taken into account when we're thinking about vaccinating people. But I would suggest to you, the ultimate problem is the for-profit nature of the pharmaceutical industry. And ultimately, we can't be trusting of people who are basically got a vested interest in pushing vaccination, getting governments to make it compulsory, and then, of course, providing the money, because, of course, that's where the money comes from, taxpayers, for these people to make private profits, because they've got a vested interest in vaccinating. Vaccination should be a medical decision taken purely on medical criteria, not on any profit criteria at all. And they try to cover this up all the time. But basically, Bill Gates makes money out of vaccines. That's what he does. And he can pretend that he's giving money away through his not-for-profit corporations and trusts. And, of course, basically what he's doing is he's avoiding tax because he's put it into these not-for-profit trusts. The not-for-profit trusts go out and push for vaccines, and then the companies that he's invested in for profit provide the vaccines.
Martin, so you missed out some very important factor. You missed out a very important factor there, one of which is that many of these trials that Bill Gates has been doing of vaccines over the last 30 years or so in different parts of the world have either given people a disease that they didn't have, for example, polio, have left them sterilized or killed people around the world. And in fact, Bill Gates's vaccine programs have been actually kicked out by governments around the world, many of them.
That's right. He was kicked out of India because his polio vaccine led to people getting polio. Now, of course, a more sinister aspect of this may be that he wants people to die off because he's basically in favor of reducing the human population. We know that. But ultimately, you've got to distinguish that from the wider question of would a vaccine be a helpful thing in a particular medical emergency? And that's a medical question. But Bill Gates ain't a doctor. He's a billionaire businessman.
He didn't even get a degree, did he? And he's also a monopolist. It's quite clear he used dirty tricks in the same way as the Rockefeller family did to take over the oil industry, to take over the computer operating system industry, Windows.
Basically allowed to do that by the deep state in the US.
Anyway, the big take home from the Tesla is the red phase partial lift, which is what it looks like we may be getting on Monday, the 11th of May, the bank holiday, which means, and let's see how accurate our prediction from 2 weeks ago is, and the Daily Mirror's, small non-residential shops may be allowed to reopen, hairdressers, warehouses, nurseries, and travel is possible but discouraged, which I don't imagine is going to be all that much different to the way it is today. A lot of this, of course, Martin, is really been about sort of self-policing. What do you make about that? The idea that people have been afraid. In fact, it seems to me the mass media has been used to actually terrify people with some of its fake news and actually inaccurate reporting. And that people, the idea is that people would just, rather than just obey the law, is just simply stay at home in fear rather than go out at all.
Well, I think there's been generally a good response to the lockdown proposals that have been made. And I think in actual fact, the government are out of step with popular opinion. If they release, if we have a release in the lockdown and then we have another spike in infections, then we'll have to lock down even tighter. So it's better, in my view, to have a reasonable lockdown. For example, you could ease certain things. I mean, people, as I can see in Bristol, pretty much using the parks openly, and that you may say, well, okay, well, let's do that because we're possibly not going to come out of this lockdown for years. So if we're going to do it for years, we've got to make it bearable.
And this is where Sweden will say that they are scoring, because by allowing young people to catch the virus who aren't at danger from it, they're actually making it so that there is a very unlikely to be any kind of second wave or second spike in Sweden. Anyway, thanks to our guests. That's Labour councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, who had to go about three quarters of the way through there, and we couldn't reconnect with her. So join us after some music as we take our weekly look around the world.
Thank you. from 1983. That was Tears for Fears. I don't think you need to be told the title of that song. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. An abortive US attack on oil-rich Venezuela, an act of war, like regular Israeli acts of war now bombing Syria. But these attempts of our so-called allies to start wars, which are going on regularly now, these war crimes are going virtually unreported in the London media. That's why we're here, folks. Germany also issues what some have called a declaration of war, a very different type of declaration, against the European Central Bank. What does this mean for the much-needed Eurozone bailouts and the EU's future? And the BBC. The news reports a Dawn Chorus Day last weekend, but not International Press Freedom Day. Was their former employee, George Orwell, right about the BBC being the Ministry of Truth, a clear and present danger to the nation? And the real VE Day behind the BBC hype, betrayal and victory on the 8th of May, 1945. First, the atomic bomb. Evidence emerging over the last 3 years or so through official documents and discovery of radioactive material in Germany that the Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944 near the town of Ludwigslust, 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 1945. Then the deals done by Churchill, Roosevelt and Truman for $1 billion in looted wealth for Nazi-enriched uranium, for experimental data from barbaric human testing, all carried out through the working of to death of human prisoners, Hitler's so-called Untermensch. And the greatest betrayal of all, perhaps, the aid given by the Allied leaders to a covert financial Fourth Reich of banksters and transnational corporations, the SS in suits in their supporters, an international mafia, directing an international NATO Bilderberg operation even unto this day, some say. And finally, on VE Day, whatever happened to Winston Churchill's finest hour speech about Britain standing up to the threat of Christian civilization, when Christians can now be prosecuted through the British courts for practicing what they preach? Anyway, we'll start this week with Martin. If you want to just relate to us some of the things you've been digging out, you've been emailing me during the week. What about some of the stories that you've picked up which you think throw particular light on what's really been going on over the last 7 days?
Well, you mentioned earlier the Bay of Piglets incident in Venezuela, where several people have been killed, ex-US Special Forces mercenaries have been captured. Pompeo said that they were, the US government were not directly involved, but of course they'd put a $15 million, I believe, price on the head of Nicolas Maduro, the elected head of Venezuela.
This is a sort of bounty.
Yeah. And these
sort of wanted dead or alive. This sounds like something from a Wild West movie.
It does. And it's fairly clear that US intelligence were behind this operation, but they wanted it to be plausibly deniable. But of course, as the Venezuelans say, what if we were to send commandos to the US to try and seize your president? That would be regarded as an act of war, wouldn't it? Because
well,
it is.
Or assassinate him.
Well, indeed. And of course, this is in the middle of a coronavirus crisis, which is supposedly, the top of everybody's agenda. And both Venezuela and Iran have approached the IMF for loans in order to help them deal with the problems, and have been told that they can't have them, and that all maximum pressure to try and get regime change in Venezuela and Iran are still on the books. So if anybody was thinking that the coronavirus was going to lead to a situation where everybody would ease up on the warmongering, then they'd be completely wrong.
Well,
it's quite clear that the US are determined to push the advantage here.
They say you never let a good crisis go to waste. Are there any other things that have been going on this week you think that where some of the most more powerful people in the world have been using this coronavirus as an opportunity to get away with stuff they might otherwise have had to face more scrutiny for?
Well, I mean, obviously the main thing that's been floating out there this week in relation to the main story, the coronavirus story, is this leak to the Murdoch press in Australia of a supposedly secret document which supposedly proves that the virus originated in the laboratory in Wuhan, which of course is exactly what Trump and his electoral strategist is going to try and push now. He's going to try and be re-elected as President of the United States on a China caused the virus platform. Interestingly enough, there seems to be tension between whoever leaked this and the actual intelligence services in the West, you know, the MI6, NSA. They basically have come out and, you know, through anonymous spokespeople to The Guardian, for example, saying, well, this isn't our material. So what's happened is somebody in the US government has leaked this to try and blacken the name of the Chinese, but they haven't cleared it with the intelligence services.
Well, it's interesting that you should say this happened in Australia, because, I mean, I've just come back from the Antipodes from New Zealand, and I can tell you it's a very different attitude to China there. I think that they are nervous, very nervous, about the idea that China could extend its power in the Pacific and that Australia and New Zealand could be easy meat. Now, do you think there's any justification whatsoever for the New Zealanders and the Australians to be more afraid of China than, say, for example, we are here in Europe?
Well, I think the problem for all nations in the Pacific is that the Chinese are there to stay, and they're developing a massive economy. I mean, Australia's main trading partner, the people who buy their exports, which, you know, which are things like coal and iron, that is China. And Australia basically shrugged off the financial crisis in 2008 because the Chinese rebooted their economy, and the Australians are basically intimately integrated into the Chinese economy. So it's all very well for them to fear China, but basically China is what puts the food on the table in Australia and New Zealand.
Let's cut to the chase, because surely if there were a world war broke out, you know, it's quite feasible that Australia and New Zealand would just be easy meat. China would occupy them very, very
quickly. No, you're mixing it up with World War II. If a war breaks out between China and the West, it'll all be fought in the South China Sea. That's where it'll happen. It's not the Chinese aren't going to surge out of China into Australia, which is in fact quite a long way away from them. What will happen, of course, in Australia, if there's any kind of break with China, is that the Australian economy will collapse because they're dependent upon Chinese demand to run their economy. And New Zealand is an even smaller economy, and they're very much dependent on what happens out elsewhere. So, of course, for cultural reasons, Australia and New Zealand are very much in the pocket of the Yanks and the British. And if the Yanks and the British want a war with China, no doubt, as in World War I and World War II, they will obediently line up, even though it's not in their interests. Ultimately, I mean, John Pilger produced a very good documentary about this some years ago now, The Coming War on China. And he's an Australian by origin. And, of course, he's very well aware of these kind of tensions. It creates massive schizophrenia in both countries because culturally they are, and particularly Australia, very much in the Western camp. But at the same time, they're very much economically dependent on China. They don't sell much to the US or to Britain.
Well, we had International Press Freedom Day last weekend, and although you wouldn't necessarily know it, well, you wouldn't know it by watching BBC News. They didn't say anything about it at all, deciding instead to concentrate on International Dawn Chorus Day, whatever that is. I think it's just been invented as some sort of gimmick. But anyway, this is one tension with Australia, Martin, isn't it? That as an Australian citizen, Julian Assange is actually very, very well respected in Australia, very well understood over there. His work as a journalist has been very much appreciated by Australians. And yet here is Britain potentially about to extradite Assange to the United States for a crime. Well, what crime? no crime whatsoever. So this could actually be an enormous rift potentially between us and the Australians.
Well, I think the Australian media have been very strong in supporting Assange, like the equivalent of the NUJ and so on. The Australian government, the Morrison government, is essentially a puppet government for the US, and they have done nothing to protect him. And that's caused a scandal in Australia in more liberal circles, if you like. This is the Five Eyes that people talk about, you know, Britain, the US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. They are the core of the anti-Chinese, anti-Russian coalition. And of course, the intelligence services are the key, they're the linkages. And of course, the politicians in New Zealand, for example, don't necessarily control their own intelligence services, which are run by the British and the Americans.
But what about in Britain? Do the politicians control the British intelligence, MI5, 6, etc.?
I don't think they do. I think in actual fact, the intelligence infrastructure is part of the deep state, which answers partly only to itself, but also to powerful oligarchic interests, which basically run all of our societies under a facade of democracy.
Well, anyway, so we're not going to ignore International Press Freedom Day, that's for sure, even though we are ourselves a show that is begging the managing editor of BCFM to let us back on FM. We don't think that what we're doing is breaking any Ofcom rules or guidelines, and certainly I personally am prepared to defend anything and put my time and effort into defending any complaints. So any of our listeners would like to urge the BCFM management to allow us back on FM, if Ofcom would like to, then please do. You know, that would be very helpful. But on Press Freedom Day, we are obviously in a situation ourselves where we're not broadcasting on FM anymore. Supposedly, that's all because of the COVID-19 virus. But, you know, as I say, I don't think we're breaking any Ofcom guidance. But let's listen now to what the now criminalised, actually potentially jailed for several years, former ambassador to Uzbekistan, who lost his job because he refused to condone torture in Uzbekistan. His name's Craig Murray. He's a Scottish nationalist. And here he is, a week or so ago, talking about what he calls the torture of Julian Assange, one of the most important investigative journalists and publishers in the world.
The torture of Julian Assange and the extreme conditions in which he's being held, his mistreatment in Belmarsh jail, is being confined to a glass box. To a large extent, they're doing it because they can, and they're doing it to show us that they can, to demonstrate the power of the state and to make us afraid. That fear is obviously particularly aimed at Tristan, for example, because it's meant to terrify Tristan about what's liable to happen to him and to the other people in WikiLeaks if WikiLeaks continues its work. It's a demonstration of It's an act of terror. It's designed to terrify us into stopping opposition to the security state and to terrify us into never again releasing evidence of war crimes. And I think when you look at the sheer malicious, the malign way that the judge Vanessa Bereitzer is conducting the court, and several of us here have been in the court, and all of us, I think, have just been absolutely stunned by the relentless and remorseless hostility of the judges and of the court, and the lack of even the appearance of civility that normally cloaks the horror of state violence that lies behind court proceedings. All that is an act of terror. It's an act designed to terrify us out of resistance. And that is the purpose of it.
Martin, I mean, this is really, some people might suggest that what Craig Murray's doing there is undermining the role of the court, but he's pointing out that actually the judge in this case has not acted in a balanced or fair manner towards Julian Assange. So it's absolutely right that someone speaks out when observing that. And he, of course, has been sitting there himself in the court and seen this directly.
Well, that's right. And of course, there's also questions about conflict of interest with the judges who have links to people who are benefiting from the military industrial complex and are quite high up in the deep state. And this is all going on. Most people are ignoring it. They've just forgotten all about it. The alternative media are picking up on it. And as Craig Murray points out, the message for the alternative media, for people like us, is look what we can do and you can't stop us. Meanwhile, the rest of the world obviously is turning its head away and doesn't even know what's going on because they've been plenty of other things to think about.
Well, we've also heard this week that Julian Assange's case has been put off for several months. I think it's October or September that it's going to be to actually taking place. This is seen by his defence team as a victory, Martin, I suppose, in that it's only going to delay the process. But actually, of course, for Julian Assange himself, this is just longer and longer. He's got to wait for any kind of semblance of justice in a system which doesn't seem to believe in justice.
Yeah, well, I mean, I take on board what the defence team asked for this September date, and they seem to have got it because the US people who are in the court agreed to it. The British were prepared to just go along with what they'd originally planned. So, I mean, this is probably one of the most important court cases in the world today, even though, as I said earlier, the mainstream media are largely ignoring it. The implications of it are enormous. And I think, as we are here in England, the home of Magna Carta, this is actually a complete defiance of English common law. He hasn't committed any offence in English common law. We have no Espionage Act here. The Espionage Act itself, under which he's being extradited to the United States, is clearly a political act, and therefore under English law he shouldn't be extradited for a political charge. And of course it's only ever been used in the US for political persecution. It was brought in 1917 to smash the anti-war movement in the United States. And it led to the imprisonment of Eugene Debs, who was a senator, who was a leader of the Socialist Party. And it also led to Bill Hayward fleeing, who was a trade union leader, fleeing to Russia. So in other words, it's an extremely undemocratic law in the first place. And of course, the other thing is that Assange is not a British citizen and he's not a US citizen. He's an Australian citizen. So how he can be arrested in Britain for being a traitor to the United States when he is in fact an Australian citizen just defies belief. And of course, what it is a clear message to everybody that the US will not tolerate having its nose tweaked. And of course, what WikiLeaks has exposed over the years is some of the most important and critical journalistic scoops of modern times.
Well, I mean, I was due to step up to the podium in Southport at the National Union of Journalists delegate meeting last week to put the case for the union also backing Julian Assange, effectively saying this guy is not a terrorist, he has committed no actual crime. And that conference has been postponed as part of the coronavirus. So it's not even as if journalists are allowed to actually conduct their meeting. The union is not allowed to conduct its meeting under the present government rules.
Well, that's right. And because of the ongoing major crisis, lots of small stuff, which we in normal circumstances would be being chased up and things would be being looked into, are all being, they're basically getting away with an awful lot of stuff which they wouldn't be able to get away with in other circumstances.
Yeah, but you're defending this lockdown, Martin. Actually, it's meaning a lot of our civil liberties have been torn up.
I think that the civil liberties aspect of this is extremely worrying. I'm not suggesting for a moment that the government should be trusted in every aspect of this, of what they're trying to do. But a lockdown is, if it's going to work, has got to be based upon genuine medical reasons. And you will understand why the NUJ can't have a conference if nobody else can have a conference. Nobody's having any conferences at the moment. The NUJ aren't being singled out there, are they?
Looking at some other international stories, do feel free, Martin, if you want to bring in some more of your stuff this week. But World War III, this is in the Daily Express, how Japan could be a glove over a US fist in this fight against China. They say World War III fears have intensified as Donald Trump is ramping up his coronavirus rhetoric against China. But an unearthed documentary suggests Japan, in a strategic sense, could be the glove over Washington's fist. So, I mean, obviously, there's China and Japan have got rivalries anyway. But is, as the Express is suggesting here, Japan actually really just acting in some way as a kind of proxy for the US in that part of the world?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, Japan is still under military occupation by the Americans, and they are there in order to threaten the Chinese. That's the reason they're there. And everybody's saying they're there to protect Japan from China. Well, that just ain't the case, is it? There's no threat from China to Japan. The U.S. military are basically surrounding China with bases and other, mobile forces. And they're also, of course, just ripped up the intermediate forces, nuclear missile treaty with the Russians, so that they can now openly surround China with cruise missiles. The Chinese see themselves as under siege by the Western powers. And of course, don't forget that the Chinese have to import a lot of raw materials through the South China Sea. It's a bit like Britain wanting to control the Channel. You know, we've controlled the Channel since we've had a Royal Navy in the 17th century, and we wouldn't let anybody get into a position where they could control the Channel, not even in World War II. And that's exactly what the Chinese are saying. You can't control our access to the sea near where our country is. It's important strategically for us to be able to bring stuff in and out without you stopping us. If we were to blockade Los Angeles, you would feel the same, wouldn't you?
You mentioned there a little earlier the whole problem with the coming war on China, the John Pilger film. In that film, Martin, it's extraordinary because it exposes an incredible thing that happened during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a very high state of readiness for nuclear war between the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union, and NATO, the NATO countries, particularly the United States. So basically it was the US and the Soviet Union were a hair trigger for nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And during that crisis, as Pilger exposes in his film, there were the nuclear weapons in the South China Sea or the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific Ocean were given an order by the US military to fire on China. And as Pilger explains, that the commanders on the ground, one particular guy countermanded the order. He said, well, actually, we're not at war with China. We are potentially at war with Russia, but we're not going to carry out this order. But orders actually came down the line, which I find extraordinary, to actually fire live nuclear weapons at the Chinese from the Pacific.
Well, we came much closer to nuclear Armageddon there than people realise. And that's not been the only time. In 1983, at the height of the cruise missiles being put into Western Europe, we nearly came to a crisis. And underlying all of this is NATO's doctrine of not saying that it won't carry out a first strike. Basically, NATO's policy has always been to say, we're not saying that we won't carry out a first strike. The other side has got to fear a first strike from us. Both Russia and China have always said, we will never use them first, they're only defensive. But most people in the West are not aware that our policy isn't defensive. We explicitly say to the Russians and the Chinese, don't presume that we won't use them first. Now, of course, what that means is that the people on the other side have got to be absolutely on their toes, so that if there is any hint that they're about to be attacked, they immediately hit back. Now, if everybody was to say there would be no first use, then everybody could take a sigh of relief. There would be time, for example, if an incident occurred, to get on the blower and talk to the other side and say, what's going on here then? But in actual fact, we haven't got that, and that's a policy decision. So a few years ago, Jeremy Corbyn was being put under pressure. Would he press the nuclear button? Would he press the nuclear button? With the implication being that we were under attack. But in actual fact, the real question is, would he carry out a first strike? Because that's NATO policy. And people listening to this should realise that is British government policy. We are committed to a first strike. That's something we could easily get rid of if we had common sense, but we haven't.
Bit of news this week. Also, the United States has been pulling its missiles and warplanes out of Saudi Arabia. This is an interesting bit of news. We've not heard much in the mainstream at all. That's on antiwar.com. What could be going on there, do you think, Martin?
Well, it's pretty clear what's going on there. The Saudis are basically pumping oil in order to try and get market share. And on that basis, basically the US shale industry is about to go down the drain. It's not viable anyway, frankly. It never was viable. And basically it should go down the drain. But of course, Trump in an election year doesn't want to see that go down the drain. So he's losing his temper with the Saudis and he's withdrawing the Patriot missiles, which didn't protect the Saudi oil industry from the Houthi drone attack anyway. And of course, what's beginning to happen now is this global crisis develops. Is that everybody's trying to find out who their real friends are, who's on what side, where, and all the rest of it. And
well, these troops were only there, apparently, in the last couple of months to counter Iran, but now they've been withdrawn again.
Well, they're being withdrawn because the Saudis won't give up on their policy of trying to get market share through pumping oil, which basically wipes out the US shale oil industry. And, of course, Trump, being the gangster he is, says you can't do that. You can't wipe out our shale oil industry. And if you do, we're going to withdraw our protection from you. We'll just let your enemies have a go at you. And of course, basically, the Saudi state is tottering. It's on the brink of collapse, in my view, although we don't hear an awful lot about it. And all sorts of political arrangements like that are basically being tested to the limit by this crisis. It's not the coronavirus is a part of the crisis, but there's also an economic component to the crisis, which is probably more fundamental. And then there's the military and geopolitical aspects which are coming to a head. I mean, I think we are, if you know anything of history, we're barreling towards a major confrontation out of which humanity may not survive. It sounds crazy to say it, but the possibilities for mistakes here are enormous and very dangerous.
Another reason why that is because this week the Senate has failed to override Trump's veto of an Iran war resolution that could have curbed his ability to launch a strike. This is the Senate on Thursday, yesterday, failed to override President Donald Trump's veto of an Iran war powers resolution that would have curbed his ability to launch a military strike against Iran. In a 49-44 vote, supporters fell short of the two-thirds supermajority needed to overturn Trump's veto, which came on Wednesday evening. The resolution would have barred Trump from using military force against Iran without explicit congressional authorization. So really, Martin, this is a little nerve-wracking, isn't it? Because it's given a very, very clear green light to Trump that he can launch a war against Iran if he wants.
Well, in actual fact, under the US Constitution, the Congress are the only people who are supposed to declare war. It's been ignored for years. What was called, even back in the 1970s when I was at university, the growth of presidential power, the imperial presidency, I think it was called. But in theory, the Constitution says it's only Congress that can declare war. But of course, Congress wasn't consulted about the assassination of Soleimani any more than Boris Johnson was. Basically, Trump, if he wants to, or somebody like Pompeo, without even consulting with Trump, may decide to just start a war with Iran, and then the war will have started.
Senator Tim Kaine, the chief author of the resolution, blasted Trump for bringing electoral politics into the debate about war. He said it was not introduced, his resolution was not introduced to divide the Republican Party. It was not introduced to affect the election. It was introduced to stop a rush to an unnecessary war, Kaine told reporters in a conference call before Thursday's vote. But the president can't see that because all he can see is himself and the prospects for his own election.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, all Congress was trying to do there was assert its traditional right to make decisions about war and peace. Now, of course, it's all for over many years that's been eroded away to almost nothing. In actual fact, the US military and their allies and hangers-on are involved in military operations all over the world as we speak, in hundreds of countries. And the Congress doesn't get any say in it at all, really. But in theory, they're supposed to make those decisions. Trump is treating it as the Republicans who voted with the resolution are letting the side down from his point of view. Because as we all know, the most important thing in the world is that Donald Trump is re-elected on November the 5th. Everything else is secondary.
Also this week, we've seen the Department of Justice in the US dropping the case against Michael Flynn. Now, what was this case about, and why is it so important that Michael Flynn's case has been dropped?
Well, I'm not so sure it is that important. In the cats in a sack scenario that's going on in the US political elite, there's a huge row about what Trump did say or didn't say, whether Biden was involved in corruption in Ukraine or not.
This is going back before the Biden case, really. Collusion between Michael Flynn and the Russian state, apparently. But now they've said that wasn't happening.
Well, it was a load of rubbish in the first place. And in actual fact, I do read a lot of US stuff on the internet. And of course, in the US, all of this stuff is gone over endlessly by all the TV anchor people and all the rest of it about whether Trump colluded and the Russians tried to fix the election or the rest of it. It's a lot of nonsense. Flynn was a US general. He had some links to Trump. You know, he was appointed by Trump to the administration. He'd had some talks with the Russians, as you might expect for somebody at his level. And it was all turned into a whole thing about how the Russians rigged the election. Now, I'm no friend of Trump at all. But the idea that Trump was elected because the Russians got him elected is infantile. It's pathetic. But you'll find even mainstream liberal commentators in The Guardian here going on that we all know that Putin got Trump elected and that Putin's responsible. I mean, I was a Remain voter, but the idea that Leave campaign run because Putin was running it is just nuts. It's bonkers, but that's what the mainstream is full of these days. Essentially, diversionary drivel.
The other thing is, of course, Michael Flynn was doing some measures. Some called it treachery at the time, but to actually have a kind of rapprochement with the Russians, to actually make Russia America's friend and ally.
Well, one of the things he did, for example, was go to a dinner in Moscow for the anniversary of the creation of RT, which Russia Today, which I sometimes go on, because Putin was at the same dinner. And on that basis, he's been regarded as some kind of Russian stooge, blah, 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 blah. Now, in actual fact, in the modern world, we live in a globalized society. People go and do all sorts of different things. And there's, you know, ongoing contacts and discussions between people on the same level at opposite sides of Russia and the US should just be regarded as normal stuff. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to agree. There's quite clearly big differences in policy and what people want to see happen in Russia and in the US. But the idea that people shouldn't talk to each other at all is, again, just ridiculous. Of course people talk to each other, and there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Just come in with any other stories if you want, Martin. But one of them I thought you may have picked up on this week is an incredible hour and a half documentary broadcast by BBC Scotland on Tuesday this week called Eminent Monsters. I mean, obviously referring to the fact that some very, very important people were involved in some of the most horrendous Nazi-style experiments on human beings. And we'll be hearing more about some of the people who seem to want to do all sorts of deals with the Nazis at the end of the war for VE Day a bit later. But this documentary by BBC Scotland examines a guy called Ewan Cameron, who was the scientist in charge of essentially a US, obviously with British cooperation as well, program called MK Ultra. Now, many people, you know, talk about fake news, etc., but this really was a program about mind control, the idea being that you can use certain techniques, and they were building on work done by the Nazis here, in order to control vast populations of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people's opinions through the mass media.
Yeah, well, it's not just the mass media. I mean, basically, they took the view... What propaganda in World War One was relatively crude and pretty blatant on all sides. In World War Two, propaganda became more sophisticated, certainly on the Allied side. And now, of course, we've now moved on where psychological warfare operations are ongoing. Brigade 77, which we learn about through the media here, has been set up in recent years in this country. It's a section of the British Army. It has 1,000 employees, and they spend all day, every day, online, pretending to be people they're not, in order to steer political judgments and public opinion in directions suitable for the overall plan that the British armies have for example, overthrowing Assad. So we're paying for that. And what that means, effectively, is that British officers are coming onto social media platforms and sowing disinformation about what's going on and being paid by our taxes to do it. And well,
One of the most interesting, well, we're talking about undermining democracy, absolutely. One of the most interesting aspects of MK Ultra was the way it was used in order to basically spy on and use techniques for entrapment of people using sexual peccadilloes of various sorts, including prostitutes and that sort of thing. But the idea being that all the leading members of society, the opinion formers in society, could potentially be compromised. And this is something that has also been evidenced by what we've seen with the VI paedophile scandals and things like the Dutroux scandal. It does look as if there's been a program building on the research of MK Ultra and the research the Nazis did in order to get many, many people at the top echelons of society in tow, either compromised or compromisable.
Yeah, I mean, there are various aspects to this. It's a totalitarian project. So you've got the blackmailing of people in positions of authority. You've got the general bamboozlement of the population. MKUltra is a massive program. And of course, it was eventually exposed through Freedom of Information Acts. And then they said, oh, well, we're not, that we did some terrible things. Like, we fed loads of people LSD, for example, against their, without consent. All sorts of stuff like this. And of course, the standard things like assassination, character assassination, and so on. All of this has become normalized as psychological warfare. And the British Army, for example, even boasts about its capabilities in this area. And of course, what they're really doing is molding the minds of the population, their own population, to perceive the rest of the world in a certain kind of a way. And then, of course, they say, well, public opinion demands that we intervene in Syria because we've planted all these stories about chemical weapons in the media. Everybody thinks that the Syrians have carried out chemical weapons attacks. And then you can carry through a kind of, on the back of that, you can then carry out, as we have done, missile strikes into Syria. Of course, the Syrians basically did not respond, but they could have done. And they would have been within their rights in international law to do so, because they didn't carry out chemical weapons attacks. Those have been carried out by NATO-linked forces.
These acts, Martin, start looking like just simple provocations, actually. The idea is they want a response.
That's right. And, of course, the Syrians didn't respond. But I put it to you this, they could have responded, and the obvious way for them to respond was to whack a few missiles into the RAF base at Akrotiri and kill a few people. And then, of course, you really would have a casus belli. That's why they didn't do it. But on the other hand, they are risking people's lives with these provocations. At some point, people will hit back, and you will pay the price.
Well, I mean, if they were to do what we supposedly did to them, you might see a chemical attack in London, for example.
Well, indeed, but they're not going to do that because they ain't stupid. If there's a chemical attack in London blamed on the Syrians, you can be damn sure it wasn't them. It's probably our own people pretending to be the Syrians. And that's the real world we live in now. We cannot trust the deep state to protect the ordinary people. It's not there for them.
You and Cameron is certainly fascinating. The Scottish doctor behind the massive mind control operation, which built on the work of the Nazi scientists, human experimenters like Dr. Mengele, on BBC Scotland this week. Let's have a clip from that now.
I remember a nurse bringing my father down, and he'd gone from a man to this almost non-human creature. Here he starts to try to get rid of the equipment that they used to put him in sensory isolation. He's mumbling incoherently. He's trying to remove his goggles. He's trying to remove his cuffs. Over and over again, that he's incoherent.
We trust doctors. We put our lives in their hands. But some betray that trust. For the last 60 years, doctors working for the British and American governments have used psychological torture to destroy people.
They start off each interrogation to say, can I have your name? I'm mentally trying to spell my own name. I don't know what the mistake is, but I know the way I'm spelling it is wrong.
To tell this story, we need to go back to the 1950s, when Scottish psychiatrist Dr. Ewan Cameron experimented on his own patients.
The MI5 agent, he simply identified himself as Andy. When they lifted the hood over my head, I see Andrew standing in front of me in the middle of the desert in Afghanistan. Andrew would simply say repeatedly, there's nothing I or we, the British government, can do about your situation. You have to cooperate with the Americans.
They said, what do you think about waterboarding? I said, I like it a lot, and I don't think it's tough enough.
In the past, we have foolishly released hundreds and hundreds of dangerous terrorists, only to meet them again on the battlefield. I just signed an order to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay.
A few moments ago, Dr. Ewan Cameron of Montreal, chairman of the organizing committee, opened this Third World Congress of Psychiatry with these words.
These are the days and hours are the occasions that summon up determination, fire of the imagination, and drive us forward in this greatest of endeavors.
I'm about to go see the Allen Memorial Institute, where my father spent on and off 4 tragic years. I remember my dad before, and I remember my dad after. It was 1 year after my bar mitzvah, so I was 14, and I remember the Christmas holidays that year with my father pacing the house, going back and forth, singing a sort of crazy song from, I think it's the 30s, called Mares Eat Oats and Does Eat Oats and Little Lambs Eat Ivy, over and over and over again, and my being very puzzled and not understanding what was happening, which is how he ended up in 1956 going to see Ewan Cameron at the Allen Memorial Institute.
So that's a clip there from Eminent Monsters. This is a BBC Scotland programme. A lot of people very critical of the BBC, but it seems that there is still just about the spirit of real investigative journalism is alive. I mean, it's interesting to note that back in 1986, it was BBC Scotland that were raided by Special Branch for putting out a series called Secret Society, which was exposing the operation of secret cabinet committees, the Zircon satellite, which had been smuggled past the House of Commons without them being able to scrutinise it, even though it was a multi-million pound project. Cover stories were given, and it was hidden in the accounts so that MPs weren't able to scrutinise it. And that series by Duncan Campbell is still available online, and still you can still see some of the footage shot by the BBC Scotland camera people as the special branch raided Scotland in the 1980s. And it's good to see that some parts of the UK are still doing some really good investigative journalists, the BBC particular. And that film, again, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which you can still watch on the iPlayer, the film Eminent Monsters by BBC Scotland. Martin, let's go on to a different kind of warfare now. We've just heard about psychological warfare. We've heard about real warfare before that, but now it's economic warfare. And this week, Germany has issued a declaration of war, at least some German politicians have put it that way, against the European Central Bank's 1.9 trillion bailout. Now, the German government have long been actually very critical of the quantitative easing programme, this idea of creating money out of nowhere by the European Central Bank. And now the German Constitutional Court has challenged the European Central Bank to prove its massive purchasing of government debt is proportionate to face the Bundesbank actually being blocked from participating in the programme. So this is the Bundesbank, which is the German Central Bank, actually coming up against the European Central Bank.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously what's happening in the US with the Federal Reserve, because it's a very slapdash setup over there, they have just piled into the market to prop it all up, and not just US companies. The whole global system is being propped up by the Federal Reserve. And, of course, there's nothing in the Federal Reserve's constitution that allows it to do this, but they've done it anyway, because there's no checks and balances. In Germany, where you've got a more legalistic culture, they've basically been chipping away. I mean, been very resistant to the idea of creating any kind of bailout. It's bizarre, really, because ultimately, if they don't bail out the southern European countries will default, and that will crash the German economy. So it's a very much cutting off your nose to spite your face situation. But they probably will not allow the ECB to create facilities to help Spain and Italy in particular, and then they will go down the drain. But as Spain and Italy go down the drain, Germany will go down the drain, and Britain, of course, in or out of the EU, will go down the drain as well, because in actual fact, everything's connected to everything else.
Well,
and you can't just walk away.
Hang on, because the court said the decision published today does not concern any financial assistance measures taken by the European Union or the European Central Bank in the context of the current coronavirus crisis. Ahead of the judgment, there were fears a ruling against the European Central Bank could have triggered a serious Eurozone crisis. The European Central Bank has bought more than 1.9 trillion pounds, that's 2.2 trillion euros, of public sector debt since launching its quantitative easing programme back in 2014. So they're not specifically looking at this coronavirus and saying, we don't like that. What they're saying is, effectively, what you were saying earlier, is you're using, the European Central Bank is using the coronavirus crisis to print money to actually undermine the entire basis of European economies.
No, well, I mean, you're mixing various things up there. What, as I understand it, what the Constitutional Court in Germany has done, which is significant, is they've said that what's happened so far, where the ECB has been buying up some bonds and so on, pretty much like the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, that is unconstitutional under German law. Now, if that is carried through, that means that the ECB can't do what it's already been doing, never mind do anything else as a result of the coronavirus crisis. Now, if this carries through, there will be a massive collapse in the European economy. There's going to be one anyway, even if they did agree to print money, just as the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England do. It's not going to be enough. In this situation, the possibility, we're talking about a second wave of the virus, but over the summer, the banking system may collapse. It's been on the verge of collapse since 2008, and we've now reached the point where, especially if things like this start occurring, the whole thing is going to go down like a house of cards, and then we really will be in a very serious situation.
Well, we are in a serious situation with the virus around the world. And on Newsnight this week, I was absolutely quite shocked to see a NHS doctor come on demanding that the former Foreign Secretary and Labour MP David Miliband, and not to be confused with his brother Ed Miliband, who was leader of the opposition, David Miliband, should lead the world against coronavirus. So let's have a listen to David Notnow, the doctor, speaking on to Kirsty Walk, I think it was, on the BBC's Newsnight programme this week.
You're very, very concerned about the impact still yet to hit on both refugee camps and areas of other settlements, particularly in developing world.
Very much so. I mean, we had a massive amount of infrastructure. We had equipment, we had ventilators, we had nursing staff, we had doctors. And when you think about the results that we had, this disease is so virulent, it's so dangerous and so pathogenic, it causes such high mortality that results recently that have been published from the Intensive Care Society have shown that 65% of patients that in the best hands possible died. And if you had another kidney problem or something on top of that, then you had an 80% chance of dying on a ventilator.
The scenario you are suggesting is that by the very fact that we are so inward looking, we have actually got another crisis on the global doorstep.
Absolutely. If you look at David Miliband and you look at his International Rescue Committee, he did some modelling based on the Imperial College and WHO. And in 34 fragile countries, he's shown that in the next few weeks, if we don't do anything, 500 million or 1 billion people will become infected. And of that, 3 million will possibly die. And that is in the low-income countries, hostile environments, and so on. And so the big problem is that it's nothing to do with ventilatory support in these countries. We really, really have to ramp up public health support in all these countries. Otherwise, it'll be too late.
Yeah, but you saw the failure of international cooperation in Syria. What you seem to be suggesting is that you have doubts about international cooperation here on this front unless it's led by somebody specific. Not a country, not a group, not a committee.
This is a global problem, and we're really all in different, our little countries, dealing with the problems on our own and making big mistakes not our countries, but other countries are making huge mistakes. And when you look at the Ebola crisis and you look at, you know, what happened in the monetary system in 2008, it was led by a global leader, really, and that was America. But now I don't think we've got that global leadership anymore. And what we really, really need is a global pandemic executive, perhaps, which can go to every country of this world and say, look, we have learnt from this pandemic. We have learnt how to deal with it. We know what the problems are.
Led by whom?
Led by David Miliband, without a shadow of a doubt. You've got somebody who's a respectful statesman, politician, and has an enormous track record, and he needs to be in charge of it. We really need to get our act together within the next few weeks. What we have is this time now, which is like February, for us, what we had this year. We have now got their February this time. So we've got 4 weeks to do as much preventative treatment, much preventative care as we possibly can. Ramp up public health services, get people in, for example, water consultants, engineers, make sure that all these countries have proper hand washing, have facilities for social distancing, because that is the only way that this virus is going to be contained.
So that's Dr. David Knott speaking on Newsnight this week to Kirsty Walk. Apparently we need a global pandemic executive, Martin, and David Miliband is the man to lead it.
Well, I mean, the political unreality of that is extraordinary. There's no particular reason why we're going to appoint anybody to be a super national authority to deal with the crisis. And why David Miliband? The International Rescue Committee, I used to run across their people, I used to work with their people in Bosnia, and we used to joke about them calling them Thunderbirds. There's no particular reason why he or anybody else should be appointed to such a body. Why? And of course, there is a problem in the developing world and something needs to be done. But it's quite likely it won't be done because, as pointed out, we've only got a few weeks to do it and it ain't going to happen.
Let's also remind everybody about the Roland Dumas statement, which he made about the meeting he was sent over to in London in 2009 when David Miliband was Foreign Secretary, which was about the, supposedly anyway, recruiting various supporters for starting a civil war in Syria. And that it was done under David Miliband's watch. The other thing Miliband did is he was actually encouraging torture. And it was only after the Tory government came in 2010 that it was revealed that Miliband himself had been involved in basically giving a nod and a wink for torture going on. And people like Bijami Brahimi, who potentially anyway should have been in the courts, and MI6 and MI5 could have been prosecuted for his torture. It was then Keir Starmer as Director of Public Prosecutions that meant that there were no prosecutions. So surely David Miliband is the last person anyone should think of. He's been involved in sanctioning torture from the top, and also, of course, involved in potentially anyway in starting the Syrian civil war.
This is interesting that Kirsty Walk there said we didn't have any international cooperation over Syria. What she means by that is we didn't go to war with Assad. And that's, of course, what was being pushed at the time. And, of course, Miliband, David Miliband, was very much embedded in the Atlanticist pro-NATO wing of the Labour Party, which is one of the reasons why his brother beat him to be Labour leader, because we didn't trust Miliband. Miliband had gone along with the Iraq war, and in many respects, as far as we were concerned, he was damaged goods, and we weren't having him.
I know you have done some door knocking with David Miliband as part of the Labour Party here in Bristol too.
Yes, that's right.
How come he decided to sort of give up on the Labour Party and go and?
When he didn't win the leadership, he went off in a huff, basically, and his brother took it over. I mean, I suppose in a way you could argue he wanted to give his brother a clear go, so he got out of the way. And, of course, he then went off to New York to head up the IRC on a salary of about $500,000 a year. He's become one of the great and the good. And it's not surprising that he's based in the US, because his politics have always been very close to those of the US establishment.
Give us an idea of what this International Rescue Committee is. You say it's called Thunderbirds. Yes,
we used to call them Thunderbirds. They were set up in World War II to rescue Jewish families from Nazi persecution, but they've subsequently become a major NGO operating in crisis situations all around the world. But of course they were, David Miliband at one stage was pushing for military intervention in Syria, get this, so that they could carry out a vaccination program. Because he said that we'll have to get into Syria so that we can vaccinate the kids. I mean, talk about, you know, missing the point entirely. And, of course, underlying all of this is that the war in Syria was created by the NATO intelligence services. They armed and trained the jihadi terrorists, which tried to overthrow the government of Assad. Assad won a democratic election in 2014. It's completely ignored in the West. Many people were not happy with the regime previously, but when they saw who was trying to overthrow the regime, they rallied round the Assad family, basically, because they're a family business.
Martin, another aspect of the sort of coronavirus pandemic, let's just bring it back to home for a second and maybe look at the international implications of this too, is that the government is apparently, according to The Guardian, using the pandemic to transfer the NHS over to the private sector, offering a load of new contracts to private companies, the stuff that used to be done by the Nationalised Health Service.
Yeah, well, they've been running the NHS down for years. So when a crisis like this happens, they say, oh, we haven't got capacity, we'll have to bring in the private sector. And, of course, they're not letting a good crisis go to waste. There's a possibility, as we were discussing in the first hour, that the government could actually step up to the plate here and basically take over running the economy. That's effectively what we're saying. You know, if we're going to have lockdowns like this, the government's got to run it all. A bit like World War II. Yeah, we're going to have a planned economy. But, of course, they don't want that. What they're going to use it for is a mechanism to try and bring through all the things they were going to bring through anyway, and more privatisation, et cetera, et cetera. And I've no confidence whatsoever that the current Tory government will do the right thing here. They've been forced to some extent to do the right thing, but of course they haven't even done the right thing in the right way. They're bailing out companies instead of bailing out the people. If you bail the people out, they can then float the companies that they think are viable. If you bail the companies out, you've got a middleman there that you might not want. Loads of businesses are not going to survive this crisis. There is no point bailing out businesses that aren't going to be there when the crisis is over. And of course, the crisis isn't going to be over. It's just started. It's going to end in a major economic collapse. And then there is going to be social change of some kind. So a very major social change. It could be positive, or it could be horribly negative.
Martin, that social change could come about through starvation and eviction.
Well, it's going to come out, yes, and war. I mean, the war zones around the world are still ramping up. We were talking earlier about the attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela. At any moment now, it could break out in the Gulf. The possibilities here are all pretty horrendous. But inevitably, there was always going to be a third. It's quite clear that what's going on now is equivalent to World War One and World War Two. This is World War Three, and it's very different. Each war is uniquely horrible in its own way. This one is going to be uniquely horrible. Probably people listening now will not see the end of it. Hopefully out of it may come something better because of the reaction to everything being so badly mismanaged. But the real danger, of course, is it's all just going to go down the drain. In poorer countries, definitely. In richer countries, likely. It's not going to be fun. It's going to be...
Martin, you're painting a very negative picture about this, but actually, for a lot of people, the lockdowns, the pandemic hasn't been too bad. They've been able to actually spend a bit of time getting to know their family and out enjoying the sun.
Well, I mean, personally, I have not suffered too much as a result of all of this yet. But the fact is that people have, it's allowed us to take a step back, those who aren't directly on the front line, and think about what really matters in life. And that could lead to changes of values which could be productive and useful to us. Going forward, we need to build a better society that looks after everybody. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it? If you've got stuff like this out there, no man is an island. If small countries or poor countries go down the drain and become hopelessly infected with coronavirus, that is going to come back to bite you in the bum wherever you live.
For homeless people in Bristol, you know, suddenly they're put up in hotels. I mean, so there's a little bit of a silver lining too, sure.
There was a silver lining to World War II, if you remember. Yeah, and out of it came the National Health Service as a concept. So here we are on VE Day, and everybody, in theory, including the Tory government, thinks the NHS is a wonderful organisation. They just haven't bothered to spend any money on it for years. And basically, if you look at the stuff that the people in the cabinet have written in Britannia Unchained, which came out some years ago, they basically, their aspiration is to break it up and destroy it. They're on the record of saying that. Now they're coming out in front of everybody saying, isn't it wonderful? And the other thing, of course, is all the people working in care homes, doing absolutely essential work, looking after the ill, the old, the frail. And they are basically being thrown to the wolves. And we ought to, out of this, develop a completely different attitude to people doing that kind of work. They need to massively increase what they're paid. They need to have jobs for life. They need to have trade union representation. They need to work directly for the government, not for rip-off private enterprise. And that is the sort of thing that we did in Britain at the end of the 1940s. Why can't we do it again?
Well, the RE or VE Day behind the BBC hype we look at today. And first, the atom bomb, evidence emerging over the last 2 or 3 years through official documents and the discovery of radioactive material in Germany. The Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944. That's 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 1945. Martin, I mean, this is an incredible revelation. It's not been sort of one news story, but it's been trickling out over the last 3 years or so, which is amazing, isn't it? Since it's 75 years after the event, the end of the war, that information is coming to light, that actually the Nazis were way, way ahead of the Americans on the atom bomb. And this also throws into effective relief the attitude of Winston Churchill in 1944 and 1945. If you read all the various literature on the subject, and there's quite a bit around, not least of which is the scientific literature, which suggests that I think it was I'm just trying to remember the guy's name. He wrote a book called Most Secret War. I can't remember his name, actually, but he was saying that Churchill was absolutely paranoid at the end of the war that there was going to be some kind of R.V. Jones, that's right, Most Secret War, that there was going to be a V2 with an atom bomb on it was going to hit London in late 44, early 45 sometime. And the evidence is now that that is absolutely was a correct threat. Churchill knew what he was saying because in October there'd been a nuclear test. And actually Churchill would have known that because it's come out in documents, you know, 70 years or so after the war, that the intelligence services had got reports of it.
Well, I mean, obviously, for some people listening, they're going to say, wow, this is all very, this is very convoluted. I think we'll need to put links up on the show for people to investigate this for themselves. But the idea that some kind of deal was done with elements within the Nazi regime at the end of the war, I think that's pretty clear. The head of the BND, the West German Secret Services, after the war, was Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of the Gestapo.
Well, look, let's just, can we just can we stick with the nuclear question, please? Recently declassified file APO-696 from the National Archives in Washington is a detailed survey of how far Third Reich scientists got in the development of an atom bomb, something Hitler craved. In the file obtained by the daily newspaper Bild, the task of the academics who prepared the paper between 1944 and 1947 was investigations, research, developments and practical use of the German atomic bomb. The report was prepared by countless American and British intelligence officers and also includes the testimony of four German experts, two chemical physicists, a chemist and a missile expert. It concurs that Hitler's scientists failed in the quest to achieve a breakthrough in nuclear technology, but that there was a documented test of a warhead in 1944. The statement of the German test pilot Hans Zinser in the file is considered hard evidence. The missile expert says he observed in 1944 a mushroom cloud in the sky during a test flight near Ludwigslust. His log submitted to the Allied investigators reads, "In early October 1944, I flew away 12 to 15 kilometres from a nuclear test station near Ludwigslust, south of Lübeck." And in fact, in this article, I'll put a link up on our show page, they've got the actual intelligence report from the war. It said a cloud shaped like a mushroom with turbulent billowing sections at about 7,000 metres stood without any seeming connections over the spot where the explosion took place. Now, is this credible, I'll ask you, that the Germans were so far ahead, you know, 9 months ahead of the Americans, actually, in testing atomic weapons?
Well, I understand that the implication of all of this is that a deal was done with elements within the regime, and they then got access to Germany's nuclear program, which allowed them to expedite their program to nuke Japan. And, of course, deals were done, as we know. But Bormann was probably, well, we know, was taken out of Berlin at the end of in 1945 by the British and then ends up in...
OK, well, look, there's another report as well, also from 2017 in the newspapers. This one, I think, is in the Independent, in the British Independent. An amateur treasure hunter in Germany has stumbled what he believes is radioactive material from a secret research facility dating back to World War II. 64-year-old Bernard Thernmann, he was exploring ground in Orianburg, northeast Germany, with his metal detector when it gave an unusual bleep. After bringing the mysterious object home, the pensioner alerted the authorities about his discovery of a shiny lump of metal. Police discovered the find was radioactive, leading to the evacuation of all the residents from several houses and calling emergency services. Specialists in hazmat suits searched his home and removed the suspicious object in a lead-lined container, which was then placed inside a protective suitcase. Mr. Thalmann, rather than being congratulated for finding this, is now being investigated for being in possession of unauthorized radioactive substances. German authorities revealed the area was the location of Adolf Hitler's secret uranium enrichment facility. The research center was tasked with enriching uranium oxide imported from South America to make weapons-grade plutonium. So, Martin, this is another bit of evidence here. This has only come out in the last couple of years. This is from actually 3 years ago, that there was definitely enriched uranium in Nazi Germany. So, you know, this report of an atomic bomb being tested could be real. The other thing is you've got all of the names of all of these, you know, Niels Bohr and the rest. I think he was Swedish, but many of the Eastern Europeans were the first actual atomic scientists to split the atom. Frisch and Piles in Birmingham's Nuffield University, who supposedly designed the first atomic bomb as an actual theoretical design in 1940. One of them was German, the other one Austrian. So it's hardly surprising that the Germans should have been ahead on this nuclear bomb technology, potentially a war-winning technology.
Well, Niels Bohr was Danish, but yes. Well, don't forget, one of the things that's caused problems for them is that a lot of Jewish scientists fled from Nazi Germany and ended up in the United States, taking with them a lot of the secrets that they had. And just as their racist attitude towards Ukrainians and Poles led to their loss on the Eastern Front. There's still plenty more to discover about what happened at the end of the war, because ultimately I think it's pretty clear that deals were done, dirty deals were done. And that, of course, explains an awful lot about the fascist psychological warfare technique that NATO has always embodied, going back to the 1940s when the Gladio networks were originally set up using the Wolf networks that had been set up by the Germans. So what the implication of this is that the Bormann faction in the Nazi party did a deal with the West, and they were basically led off and escaped, and they gave the nuclear weapons to the West, which then allowed, of course, the nuking of Japan, and of course then led to a situation where the Soviet Union could be contained by the Western nuclear power. And of course they definitely discussed the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union before they were able to develop any nuclear weapons.
Well, I think it'd just be interesting now to have a listen to a Horizon called Hitler's Bomb, which was produced in 1993 by the BBC. And they were, in a way, they were putting together much of this evidence, even though none of the admissions about enriched uranium that the Nazis held. I mean, we just heard in that last story I read out about Bernard Thalmann finding this bit of uranium and then getting into all sorts of trouble because he wouldn't tell the authorities there where exactly he'd found it, that actually the German authorities revealed the area of Oranienburg was the location of Adolf Hitler's secret uranium enrichment facility. Well, the question then arises, of course, what happened to that enriched uranium after the war, even though it's now been officially admitted by the German authorities that it did exist and they were producing enriched uranium. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a little section from this Horizon film from 1993. Even though the conclusion of the documentary is that the Nazis hadn't developed any kind of real nuclear capability, you can see from this excerpt that there was definitely discussions between various nuclear scientists outside Germany and inside Germany that it was definitely possible. And these discussions took place right at the beginning of the war.
In fact, what I really wanted to discuss with you this evening was a question that's been troubling me somewhat.
Really?
Concerning the military application of our work.
Military application?
I value your opinion on the moral issue, Niels. The question being, of course, whether it's right for us as scientists to be working on the uranium problem in times of war, when it's very possible that our work could lead to the most grave consequences in the technique of warfare.
You genuinely believe our work has military application, eh?
Well, of course. In theory, that is.
Wait, what? What are you saying exactly? What are you talking about? A bomb? An atomic bomb?
We've made some progress in that direction. It would take the most terrific technical effort, of course, but yes, it's a possibility.
A quarter of an hour after the end of the walk, Heisenberg saw me and said, I'm afraid it was a complete failure. And then I said, why? And he said, well, I started carefully, cautiously, and when Bohr realized that I was speaking about the possibility of making nuclear weapons, Bohr became so excited that he was not able to listen anymore.
You see why I had to speak to you. Frankly, I'm at a loss.
Yes, I see.
The Americans are bound to be working on the same problem, so what choice do we have? The result could be absolutely catastrophic. The release of energy would be so immense, it'd be decisive.
But once I approached Schumann, who was in charge of the whole thing in the military office, and said, would it not be good to tell some higher people in the government about this matter? And Schumann said, please don't do it. Because if Hitler, he said, der Führer, hears that nuclear weapons are possible, he will say half a year and then they must be there. And you know that this is not feasible, and for you and for me it would be a very bad position. Please keep away from such ideas.
Well, the Nazi scientist in charge of their bomb program was Werner Heisenberg, and there's a portrayal there in that BBC documentary, Hitler's Bomb from Horizon from 1993, of him meeting up with Niels Bohr right near the start of the war and discussing these topics. But, Martin, what apparently happened in Nazi Germany is the whole operation was considered so sensitive that it was moved out of the military program, away from the influence of people like Albert Speer, who was the armaments minister, and they decided to call it a civil program. And yet it developed as completely out of the sphere of what many people would consider to be the military. But nevertheless, it was developed. And I would just contrast this really with the way that much military research in the West has been moved into the civil area too. I did a visit to Joint European Torus at Culham Laboratory. Gosh, must be 20 years ago now, maybe even 25 years ago. And the physicist there explained to me, well, this is actually a military program under the guise of civil experimentation, because what they're doing is they're looking at the characteristics of various different substances in a nuclear explosion. And they're using the donut, they called it, the fission project, simply as a way to experiment on what would way various materials behave in a nuclear bomb. And so that was all covered as a civil in the civil budget. So it seems that idea of using civilian cover for a military weapons program is still going on today, possibly.
Well, indeed. And also, of course, in relation to this, the biological warfare labs, which are run by the Pentagon, which are all scattered around in the countries in between Russia and China, like Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other places. It's not that they claim that they are there to investigate viruses and bacteria that could cause damage, but they're all funded by the military programs. So they're basically military facilities. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians aren't happy about them being there. And they're raising questions about what is going on in these places.
Well, going back to the October 1944 German nuclear test, which there is plenty of evidence for, I'll put a link to the articles which came out in 2017 about that with the wartime intelligence documentation up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, alongside the evidence of people in Germany near Orianburg discovering actual bits and pieces of fissile material lying around. And then the government actually admitting that this was where uranium was enriched during the Nazi years. An hour later, from the previous eyewitness to that atom bomb test, a pilot in a different machine took off from Ludwigslust and observed the same phenomenon. According to other archive documents, the Italian correspondent Luigi Romersa observed on the ground the same explosion. He had been sent by dictator Benito Mussolini to watch the test of a new weapon by the Germans. He was ordered to report his impressions back to Mussolini. So tremendous amount of evidence. But Martin, the next big question here, you alluded to this earlier, is what happened to this enriched uranium? Apparently they had 500 kilos of the stuff, nearly half a ton, encased in gold, and they were ready at the end of the war to send it off to Japan in a submarine.
Yeah, but as you know, what may have happened is that that submarine was diverted by Martin Bormann to the United States, and the enriched uranium basically ended up in bombs which were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because there was a change going on behind the scenes. Elements within the Nazi regime were realigning with the Western powers against Japan in first place, and of course, ultimately, in order to contain the Soviet Union.
Well, we're speaking on the 75th anniversary of VE Day. That is to say, in 2020, the 8th of May 2020. Another aspect to all of this, Martin, is the loot, the looted wealth of Europe, which the Nazis had control of. And I think that's also a trail worth following, picked up very, very well by the CBS, former CBS wartime correspondent and journalist on the radio, broadcasting to America from Europe during World War II, who wrote a book after the war in the 1980s, actually, it was published, called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, where he describes this laundered money from Nazi Germany, from Bormann, who'd been brought out as Op JB, the book by Christopher Crichton describes, by the British, and with the collusion of Winston Churchill, with the promise to those soldiers involved, in the commandos involved in bringing Bormann out by rivers and canals from Berlin into the British sector, delivering him up to Desmond Morton, the former aide-de-camp to General Haig in World War I, the author of the Zinoviev letter in between the wars, and that money coming through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, being laundered into these 750 companies created by Bormann, but remotely from South America, and the Nazi SS people basically just putting on suits and walking into directorships for those firms, transnational companies designed to have an immense amount of wealth and power, but secretly working for a kind of Fourth Reich mafia after the war.
Well, that's right. And I think that anybody who looks into this, even cursorily, will see that elements within the Nazi state were definitely reappointed after the war, and nothing happened to them. A certain number of people were scapegoated. They were executed. There was a whole process of so-called denazification, but it was very half-hearted. And ultimately, basically, the fascist intelligence networks and other networks that were basically helped at that time became the basis, first of the OAS and then of the CIA and MI6. So the fascist intelligence structure was absorbed into NATO's intelligence structure, which is pretty clear from what I mentioned earlier about Reinhard Gehlen. He used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, and he said, "Do you want all my agents inside Russia?" And of course they said, "Yes, we do." And of course the other thing they did is the Kempeitai, the Japanese intelligence service, were all let off because they handed over all of their files on stuff they'd been doing on biological warfare by basically carrying out, you know, unethical experiments on their prisoners. And the British and the Americans got access to all of the results of those experiments on the understanding that the Japanese concerned would not be punished. And of course they weren't punished. And both modern Germany and modern Japan are stuffed with people who were complicit in war crimes in the 1940s.
Yeah, this is also the SS general, Paul Hauser. He was the commander of the Das Reich Division, an SS unit of the German army. He was using that unit right throughout the war. And at the end of the war, he said that NATO was formed from the international supporters of the SS during the war. I mean, is that feasible?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the right wing in the West and the right wing in Germany buried the hatchet, as Hitler was left out of the loop, of course, because otherwise he would have sabotaged it all. And then they went to war with the Soviet Union immediately afterwards. And they certainly discussed the possibility of nuking the Soviet Union immediately at the end of the war, because they could have done. But ultimately, of course, the communist or the Soviet intelligence operation was pretty good as well, and they'd infiltrated everything that was going on in the West, so they knew what was going on. And the Rosenbergs and Klaus Fuchs and others, who were scientists within the nuclear program in the West, basically leaked how to make an H-bomb, for example, to the Soviets. And that, of course, then leveled the playing field. You can't actually nuke them anymore because they're going to nuke you back. But that was only because the Soviets had sufficient intelligence assets to thwart it.
Well, what about this OPJB I was talking about earlier, this book by Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. John Ainsworth Davis, actually. He's Christopher Crichton, that's his real name. The idea that you can have Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, doing considerable amount of secret deals for possibly many years during the war with Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann. Is that possible?
It's not just possible, it's probably what happened. And, of course, don't forget that the Nazis coming to power in the first place was with quite a lot of nudges and helps from Western intelligence services and oligarchs like Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, who was arrested at one stage by Roosevelt for cooperating with the enemy during the 40s. The wealthy classes in the West were behind Hitler before he came to power.
Trying to bring this round to today, we're looking now at a situation with the United States attempting regime change, attacking Venezuela without any proper approval by Congress, by being very much the aggressor in world affairs, and looking actually much, much more like a kind of Nazi Germany in terms of the way that they are breaking international law. I mean, Hitler doing this stuff back in the 1930s and 40s. The US presidents, US deep state seems to be doing something rather too similar today. And Churchill, back in the war, when he was talking about, we will be the people to stand against Christian civilization. Nowadays, it almost seems as if the whole thing has turned on its head, that you've got, countries like China and Iran are basically the only ones saving the world from going down the road of might is right.
Well, that's right. I mean, the US basically, for example, they're not members of the International Criminal Court. They're quite happy when the International Criminal Court takes their political opponents and puts them on trial, but they're not prepared to submit to it themselves. And the International Criminal Court suggested that they might investigate war crimes in Afghanistan. And they're even trying to persecute the individual members of the court and make sure, ruin them in every way they possibly can. Basically, we've got a lawless regime in the United States of America, and don't forget they're far more powerful than Germany was in the 1940s, and the damage they can do is that much greater. And if you think of all the covert and overt wars that they have fought in places like Mozambique and Angola and Cambodia, the list is long. We're talking about millions and millions of dead as a result of US imperialism, and that is very dangerous.
The other thing is, the other aspect to all of this, of course, is the light thrown on the Nazi assassination programs, the imprisonment programs, the internment, the Holocaust, by Edwin Black's book, IBM and the Holocaust, because the actual records, the computer records today, are pretty much the equivalent of the punch card records, which were kept by these IBM Holorith machines in Nazi Germany. The surveillance state was very important. Back in the Nazi Germany, the Gestapo would basically press a few buttons on one of these IBM machines for any town that they could have a list of addresses, names, for the Gestapo to go around and arrest Jews, for example. A very similar sort of system is around today, what with massive profiling of the population, a massive data mining by these companies like Palantir, who boast that they can get everyone's data, and then, of course, they sell it on to anyone that wants to use it for profit. I mean, even companies like Google and Facebook collaborating with these data miners, many would say. But Martin, this is another aspect to all of this. The surveillance that is around today actually is far, far greater than the Nazis had during World War II.
Well, it is. I mean, basically, you've got to regard all of this as a development that's been ongoing for a century. And we're now reaching the turning point. We are either going to get a grip over these powerful oligarchies, which use all of these underhand techniques to control the population, or we're not. And, the decisive question is going to be asked very shortly. As the Chinese say, when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller.
And we'll finish tonight with a look at the interview I did earlier this week. I don't often have interviews with me on here, but this is on the Richie Allen Show, where I and Richie have been discussing for a long time this whole... In fact, I spoke to him first probably 12 years ago, just about the same time as we started on FM, our BCFM radio show, Martin. I was chatting to him when he was a presenter for several years, many years, actually, on Talk Radio Europe, which is an English language station in Marbella in Spain, and we used to do regular sessions on there talking about Princess Diana and all sorts of other things. And the thing I did with him this week was all really about the whole Martin Bormann story, right from start to finish, really. And I suppose the other thing to mention is the way it does actually fit in with this whole Albert Pike plan for three world wars, the idea that the First World War would be used for the British Empire to take over Palestine, to smash the Ottoman Empire and create a communist regime in Russia, the Second World War to bring communism to China and to create an Israeli state. But anyway, that aside, this is a clip about one of the most fascinating aspects of the Martin Bormann survival tale, which still hasn't really been told, is the two occasions on which the evidence supposedly came out that Bormann most definitely had died on the 1st of May 1945 as he tried to escape the Führer bunker. And as we know, Martin, you and I know, actually, there was a double sent with the British commandos, the idea being to leave this poor unsuspecting double's body in Berlin with the same teeth signature as Bormann. And it's even said in the book, John Ainsworth Davis' book, that Ainsworth Davis saw the real Martin Bormann as this guy died in Berlin, the double. He popped a pill into his mouth to make it look as if he'd also taken poison. And that was then used afterwards as evidence that they'd found poison of some sort in the skull of the dead so-called Bormann. But anyway, I thought I'd just finish with a look at the two occasions in 1972 and in the mid-1990s, mid-late 1990s, when new evidence came to light that supposedly Bormann had died in Berlin and didn't survive, wasn't rescued by the British and others, and why that may have been that evidence surfaced at that particular time.
Two main occasions where this whole idea of Bormann's body being discovered in Berlin was... firstly, when Stuart Stephen and Ladislas Farago had this Daily Express front page headline, Martin Bormann alive, literally within the next week or so, they'd suddenly discovered his body.
That's
had amazing coincidence. And the second time being upon the publication of the absolutely mind-blowing and brilliant, once you started it, I guarantee you won't stop reading. It's called Op JB, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. I'm just going to flick to the front cover to see. It's 1996 that was published, and it was literally again a couple of weeks after that was published that we got another load of stuff saying, oh, Bormann's skull has been discovered, blah, blah, blah. And the other thing to mention is that this marked the beginning of a load of sort of counter wave of books coming out saying, oh, Adolf Hitler has survived, Grey Wolf, and the rest of them.
Yeah.
Actually, they were, I believe, they were simply another strategic lie operation in order to divert attention from the fact it was Bormann that survived. Basically, Hitler had run out of steam by the end of the war. You know, he had nothing left. He was on drugs and things to try and keep him going. And he actually wanted to die. It's just some kind of like sacrificial death. That's the way he saw himself. Bormann, by the way, was the one who was entrusted with his will and brought it to London.
That's
and that's
right.
The details about that as well.
So, misinformation, you know, put out there about Hitler to obscure the truth about Bormann.
So that's part of an interview I did with Richie Allen earlier this week. I'll put up a link to that on our show page thisweek.org.uk. But I'll just leave you to summarise, Martin, what you make of this enormous turnaround that's happened since World War II. I think it's a bit premature to be celebrating VE Day when it looks as if the Western world has taken on rather too many aspects of the whole Nazi empire that they have said that they have vanquished on VE Day.
Yeah, I think it is a very, very significant turning point. What we're talking about here is the Western power structure, which has been been in existence for a long time, constantly mutates, just as dangerous as any virus.
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out, Martin, sorry, it's worth pointing out, isn't it, that Edward VIII was a Nazi. He married Morris Simpson, who was a Nazi agent. And actually over in Lisbon, he prompted the German ambassador to Portugal to start the Blitz on London. So we had a member of the royal family being the man who actually encouraged successfully the Nazi regime to actually start bombing London. So there are quite a lot of senior Nazis within the British establishment, and they were back even in the war.
Well, yeah, the Pinay Circle and others were very definitely pro-Nazi. And I'm afraid you've got plenty of people in power today who've got very similar ideas to the people that were in power then. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. The war will never end against people who are determined to try and dominate human society for their own benefit. And we've got to keep up with it. And we haven't really got an option. We're going to have to do what we can to resist them.
And what do you think of the war memorials that are all over our country now today?
What I think about them is that they are there as a reminder to all of us that the price of freedom is very high, and we've got to be prepared to pay it in every generation.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour councillor for Froome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy on Saturday morning, Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Loch. I'll be back on FM soon, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the politics show next Friday afternoon. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.